A copy of the agenda was circulated, and I'm sure you all have one. If you don't have one, could you please indicate by show of hand so that we can give you one? Does look like we all have. In terms of the agenda, we're on item number one, which is opening and welcome. I'd like us to open this meeting with a prayer, but to accommodate all the religious groupings that are there in South Africa, shall we bow our heads and observe a moment of silence for prayer or meditation? Thank you. Greetings to everyone. Indeed, briefings by greetings to the National Treasury, the South African Express Airways, the Department of Public Enterprises, and greetings to the honorable members. Thank you so much for coming. Indeed, we have a house full. It's very exciting because we will be working and working hard for the people of South Africa. Well, I have also greeted the support staff and the delegation from National Treasury, South African Express. I have done that. And I would also like to greet all the stakeholders that have shown interest in this work. You know that we only qualify as a democratic government when you show interest and you participate in our work. Thank you so much for coming. And indeed, COSATU, you never miss this opportunity. We appreciate your coming. And all other stakeholders, thank you very much. And we thank all those who will be presenting for our public hearing. And thank you for responding to the request for public submissions. Well, this is a joint meeting of the standing and select committees on appropriations from both the National Assembly as well as the NCOP. In our previous discussion on the 2018 Adjustments Appropriation Bill, the two committees agreed that National Treasury, the South African Express Airline, and the Department of Public Enterprises should come back to provide detailed responses concerning the proposed budget to the South African Express Airline. And I'm sure you understand why, because these two committees' core business is to follow where the money went, not even the money, the taxpayers' money went, and also to check on the trends in terms of your over or under performance, and also the impact in terms of your non-financial performance, the impact, because what will be the use of budgets being allocated, but we end up not seeing value for money. So that is why we want to come, especially because here, this one is an intervention. We're looking forward to a turnaround. Now, we want to be convinced that this money will be responsibly used, and indeed, it will assist us to make an impact. All right. This first session of the meeting will cover this part of us receiving the presentation from the South African Express Airline and from your Department of Public Enterprises and the National Treasury. Well, after the first session, we will receive presentations in a form of public submissions on the 2018 Adjustments Appropriation Bill. The 2018 Special Appropriation Bill and the 2018 MTBPS, Medium-Term Budget Policy Statement. This is a critical part in the work of the two appropriations committees and Parliament. Parliament exists to represent public views, and that is why the Money Bills Act requires the two appropriations committees to facilitate public involvement before money bills are passed into law. So actually, your coming to present or to make submissions will help us to qualify and also to comply. So thank you so much for assisting us to comply with the legislation that requires that we get the public views or public opinion. The organizations and individuals who made submissions include the following: Fair Play Movement, Budget Justice Coalition, UNICEF, Rural Health Advocacy Program, COSATU, Mr. D.W. Knott, as you would know, also individual submissions are allowed, and Dr. S.M. Muller. As Parliament, we appreciate all these submissions because they add value and wisdom to our work and help us also to consider the Appropriation Adjustment Bill and the Special Appropriation it's appropriation to SAA, but also the MTBPS from a broader perspective, as it would also be inclusive of the presentations and the thoughts shared with us in this public hearing. Let us then take this opportunity to carefully listen, and I have said carefully listen and critically engage. But just to also say to members, indeed, we are looking forward to a vigorous engagement with the key stakeholders that are before us. But we have another meeting after this one. So if members can indeed focus and their intervention, they are short and to the point, and also the responses also are focused and short to the point and allow us time to also to proceed with our work with the next sitting after this one. Thank you very much. So with these ones, yeah, we are welcome, and I'm looking forward to a meaningful and a constructive engagement. We will then move on to apologies. Are there any apologies? Yes, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson. With respect to the Select Committee on Appropriations, we have received 4 written apologies. Honorable Mutara, Honorable Isaac, Honorable Shabangu, and Honorable Motlashopeng. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. From the Standing Committee on Appropriations, are there any apologies?
Yes, good morning, Chairperson. We have received 3 apologies. It's from Sope Sitole, Mr. Seki Mam, and Mr. Ben Martins. Thank you.
We're not attending because that will help us to determine whether we accept or we don't accept the apologies.
Mr. Martins is on study leave. Ms. Sope Sitole is not well, and then Mr. Seki Mam didn't provide any reason. Thank you.
Okay. Honorable members, what is your take? Honourable Member Shuttleton.
Thank you, Chair. I did see an email in writing from Ellen McLachlan as well, indicating for sick leave for the week. Okay. But I think there was kind of a mix-up with that because it was sent by his secretary to the wrong email address for Mr. Orenser, but I then forwarded it to Ms. Halley for her records.
That's fine. Do we accept the apologies? Honourable Member Snukwanyame? Any seconder? Seconded. Thank you very much. Shall we then proceed with item number 3, which is briefing by National Treasury, to be followed by South African Express Airways and the Department of Public Enterprises on adjustments, appropriation, bin allocation. Now, he's going to be my timekeeper because we are pressed with time. So we are allowing this presentation at least 30 minutes. Shocked you out of you. Another 3 minutes. Okay. Okay. No, that's fine. Over to you, National Treasury.
Thank you very much, Chair. Because the SA Express presentation is already on the screen, shouldn't we start with that one quickly?
Okay. There's a proposal that we allow SA Express to start. Agreed? Agreed. You may proceed.
By way of just some very brief opening remarks from the Department of Public Enterprises. My name is Avril Helstead. I'm the Acting Deputy Director General for Transport Enterprises at the Department of Public Enterprises. So we welcome this opportunity to come to the committee. We were obviously here on Wednesday to present on SAA, and Honourable Lees indicated that he had visited SA Express, and we would have liked to have extended that invitation to the other members of this committee, as well as to the Portfolio Committee on Public Enterprises, because we really welcome that opportunity to be able to provide a comprehensive briefing. And so we're very enthusiastic about coming here to be able to provide the sort of detail that I think this committee needs in order to make the important decisions that you have to make. Just by way of some very brief opening remarks, and then I will hand over to Caesar to make the presentation. There was a new board that the Minister of Public Enterprises appointed in May this year, and that board has really been instrumental in getting the airline back into operation. They have had the support from the department, who appointed an intervention team to assist them. They looked at various areas in terms of technical, commercial, operational, and financial, and together with the board managed to see the airline return to operations in August this year. Since then, the department has withdrawn the intervention team, and with the exception of Ms. Caesar Mzimela, who is currently being appointed by the board as the interim CEO. And I think many of the members of this committee may be familiar with the fact that she has very extensive experience in the airline industry, having worked previously at SA Express, where she ran it as a profitable enterprise, and also at SAA. The board is at an advanced stage of appointing, filling the executive positions of the to appoint a permanent CEO and a permanent CFO. And the company has also been filling a lot of vacant management positions at the airline as well, which we are seeing as bringing the sort of stability that's required in order to have a successful turnaround. The company has been doing forensic investigations. They're more at the point where some of them are starting to be completed, and the board will then be considering them and taking the appropriate action after following due process. And they're also in the process of finalizing their annual financial statements. It may be an issue more for the Portfolio Committee on Public Enterprises, but we do expect to be able to table those as the department and come and discuss them with the committee in the new year. So the board has been working alongside the department in developing the strategy. Caesar will cover some of the key areas. But I think maybe just to underline some of the points that we were making on Wednesday in respect of SAA, that we are starting to see green shoots. In particular, we've seen a dramatic improvement in the performance, on-time performance of the airline, which prior to the airline being grounded was in the around 68%, and it's now in excess of 90%. And this is key for attracting back the key customers that SAA Express seeks to a service, which is mainly business customers flying in from secondary cities. And I think, I know some of the members of this committee live in towns that are serviced. I know on Wednesday there was a member from Mahikeng. And I think you, probably some of the members of this committee have actually experienced the impact of not having those operations. So we do see SA Express as playing a very key role in the economy of helping to promote trade and tourism to those secondary cities in the country. So that we can have growth not only in Joburg and Cape Town, but also just across the whole country. So with that, I'm just going to hand over to Caesar. She will take you through the presentation that's up on the screen, and then we'll hand over to Nash.
Thank you very much, Chair. Maybe before we actually start, maybe just to quickly introduce the rest of the members who are sitting here with us. Myself, I'm Caesar Mzimela, and I am the interim CEO at SA Express. Next to Avril is Dr. Tabi Lioka, who is representing the board this morning. Next to her is Mpho Selepe, who is our CFO. And next to Mpho is Ndate, who is also a member of our finance department. And Tandi, Ms. Tandi Bulene, further in the red dress, who is the acting GM for commercial. And next to me is Isaac, who is responsible for the scheduling and the pricing within South African Express. Thank you, sir.
If I may respond, it looks like a strong team, so we have to trust them. And they must not, you know, betray us on that trust.
Indeed.
Yeah. All right.
I'm just going to try and go through the presentation very quickly. So essentially what we wanted to cover this morning is just very quickly an overview of the SA Express, I mean, mandate, but I think that Avril has already covered a lot of that. And then to go straight into, I mean, the problem statement. And problem statement, in our case, talking to what actually happened and what were the issues prior to the suspension, because that is the big issue I think that we would want to actually cover. As already indicated, I mean, by Avril, on the 24th of May, SA Express, I mean, was grounded. And this was just at the point when a new board had been appointed the day before on the 23rd of May. So the board came in on the 23rd of May, and they thought they were there to try and assist the organization to grow. And the very next day, the airline was grounded. As a result of that, the focus then shifted to ensure that, I mean, they were focusing on trying to get the airline back into service, which is when, I mean, the intervention team was also brought in to try and assist with that. I thought, I mean, it would be important just to cover for the members in terms of what are the issues that we found within the system and what is it that we needed to deal with, which then talks to the response that was then put forward by the board in relation to this. Firstly, just to talk about the airline performance itself, that at that point it was a fleet. We had a fleet of 22 aircraft, and we were servicing a number of destinations, 17 domestic routes and 6, I mean, regional routes at that point in time. But although, I mean, we had a fleet size of 22, in terms of available aircraft, it was only 13 aircraft that were actually available. And key to that is just to make the point, which has created a lot of confusion in the past, where SA Express had self-grounded 9 aircraft of the 22. However, despite the fact that they self-grounded, unfortunately that was not communicated to the South African CAA. So if you do not do that, even though you have self-grounded your own, I mean, aircraft, then they come through and they have an obligation to also check on those aircraft that are grounded. And because, as I said, they were self-grounded, but they had not actually updated the civil aviation in terms of that self-grounding. This is why, it's part of the reason why CAA got to the point that they felt that the license
needs to be withdrawn, because obviously they checked the condition of those aircraft that had already been self-grounded and came to the conclusion that there were serious issues pertaining to those aircraft. I just thought it was important, I mean, to clarify that. But over and above just, I mean, the aircraft that had been self-grounded, there were obviously a number of issues within the system, and quite specifically around accountability. So zero accountability from management, where as a result of CAA having come through previously and highlighted findings where they actually give you an opportunity to come back with corrective action, because no one acted in terms of ensuring that the corrective actions were put into place, it then resulted in a repeat finding which becomes a level one finding, which means now the airline, they have to actually suspend the license. I'm taking a little bit of time to explain this, because there's always questions around what does it mean now? Does it mean the airline was not safe and flying unsafe? It was never an issue of saying the airline is flying unsafe aircraft. It was just the breakdown within our system and how we were actually dealing with issues that had actually been dealt, the CAA had already highlighted to us in previous times. And of course, there were other issues, like the shortage of skills in critical areas, and a lot of people sitting in acting positions, and CAA has what it calls post-holder positions, which are absolutely critical. And it's about ensuring that you bring in people with the necessary skills to man those post-holder positions. And that was something which was lacking, I mean, in the system. All of this obviously also resulted in us, in terms of, I mean, delays from a customer experience, which means essentially around about 64% of the time we're always late. Yeah, we're only on time 64% of the time. So half the time, or close to half the time, people knew that had no guarantee that the flight would actually leave on time or even leave. So it really had a serious impact in terms of how the airline was viewed and an impact on the customer experience. I think when the board came in, the board then put together what is actually termed a turnaround strategy. And we call it a turnaround strategy, but for us within the business, we have chosen to call it, it's about going back to the basics. And why do we say it's about going back to the basics? Is that as much as SA Express has actually experienced serious financial challenges for the last 9 to 10 years, SA Express was a highly profitable airline. And it's really about saying, what is it that is broken? What is it that we need to actually make sure that we fix in terms of taking the airline back to basics to get it back to be the airline which was profitable and was actually operating efficiently in providing the service that our customers expect, I mean, from the airlines. As a result of that, the new board adopted what they call a five-pillar strategy based on ensuring that there's proper governance in place, profitability, operational efficiency, customer value, and also ensuring some elements around human capital. So under the governance, I mean, very quickly, it's just ensuring that, I mean, we do have proper corporate governance, I mean, in place, ensuring that we have policies that are well-defined and actually help us to strengthen some of the weaknesses within the business, and likewise on profitability, areas where we want to focus on growing revenue and also decreasing costs. And on the operational efficiency, I think we've already talked about that, is that it's about ensuring that you have a very good on-time performance and that your aircraft out of the technical hangar are reliable and come out, I mean, on time in terms of dispatch reliability. Then, I mean, there were elements as well in terms of improving the customer value, I mean, proposition, in terms of the service that we actually offer. And key to all of this is ensuring that we have competent employees and that we work on changing the culture to a culture which is correct. I think that the board, in putting this together, were also very clear. They said there are certain deliverables and milestones, and they were put together in terms of a 0 to 6 and a 6 to 12. So we have what we call phase 1, which is a 0 to 6, and phase 2, which is 6 months and beyond. And why did the board choose to do this? It's because they wanted to be able to actually confirm very clear deliverables and with very clear milestones to say we can go and check against that to say have we actually delivered on these elements or not. So how have we done against all of that, those elements to date? Under the governance element, I'm happy to say that we have filled all of the vacant post holder positions with experienced aviation specialists in terms of a new head of safety, a GM of technical, person responsible for aircraft, and a person responsible for flight. So as we speak, I mean, today we are in full compliance with the regulations in terms of SACAA, and they've actually gone as far as to congratulate us for some of the appointments that we've made, because these are highly skilled individuals, which we're quite fortunate to attract back, I mean, to SA Express. We've also, from a governance perspective, focused on ensuring that certain very key policies and frameworks are reviewed and finalized relating to supply chain policy, irregular expenditure policies, fruitless and wasteful expenditure, because as you would have heard, I mean, from the acting DDG, that some of the key issues that we had, I mean, in our system is just a lot of irregular expenditure that was taking place, irregular contracts that were costing the airline a significant amount of money. So we had a situation where there was a middleman where we could actually be going directly to the OEM or the supplier, especially when it actually came to our technical maintenance area. So these are some of the things that the board actually insisted that we try and make sure that we put into place with some urgency. On the profitability aside, what have we done? We have actually reintroduced our high-yield regional routes such as Lubumbashi and Walvis Bay as part of phase one. We've also focused on consolidating OR Tambo as the main hub. Why have we chosen to do this? We had a number of bases. We had Johannesburg as a base, Durban as a base, Cape Town as a base. But this is some, we actually took the view that we need to do it step by step, which is why we're talking about a phased approach. And we started by saying we need to actually ensure that we get OR Tambo to actually work and work effectively. Because sometimes there's a rush to spread yourself very quickly and very thinly, and then it also impacts very negatively in terms of, you know, the reliability and the service that you're able to provide. It does not mean that we have no intention to go back, I mean, to some of our bases. In fact, we are quite well on track to be able, we're coming back into the Cape Town base effective January 2019. On the cost side, three of our main costs, or the three significant fixed costs within our system, was related, I mean, to our aircraft lease costs, relates, I mean, to our employee costs, and then thirdly, in relation to fuel, which is a problem which is obviously experienced by all airlines. So what have we done in terms of our aircraft lease costs? We already have been able to register some significant savings for going forward. On some of our aircraft, we've now managed to get to in the region of about 11% reduction on some of the aircraft. We have actually terminated some monthly rentals that relate to some of the aircraft lease costs. And most significantly, we've cancelled all charters that were being operated within the system, which has actually saved us in the region of about 18 million per month going forward. So we are happy with the progress that has actually been undertaken. From an employee cost perspective, we've terminated all overtime at this point in time, and where it is actually necessary, it is managed a lot better to ensure that we don't find ourselves paying double what was actually projected in terms of employee costs. And the same in terms of other initiatives that talk to, you know, the number of cars that we have in the system and so forth. And then, of course, a key focus area would be what we need to do around, I mean, the capital restructuring. And we are obviously looking forward to what is coming through into the system, which would actually assist us to improve our debt gearing and allow the organization to function, you know, properly. Still covering, I mean, the five pillars, we have improved our on-time performance from a 64% to above 90%. We have improved our aircraft reliability from 77% to above 95%. And we now, as I've already indicated, purchasing directly from the OEMs, thus reducing our costs and improving efficiencies within the system. On the customer side, we have seen, I mean, very little complaints in relation. We had significant complaints relating to missing bags, and we have actually seen a huge, I mean, reduction in terms of the complaints relating to that. And we are looking to also improve the customer experience by introducing a premium economy on the Lubumbashi route, effective, I mean, from December of this year, because it is a route where some of the passengers are willing to pay a little bit more if they can take a little bit more luggage and they have a better, I mean, offering. And then lastly but not most importantly, it is about changing the culture within the organization. That because if we have people who are aligned in terms of what needs to be achieved by the organization, it makes the job a lot more easier. It talks to that. And we have actually a focus in terms of revising and promoting some of our company values to drive a culture of accountability and performance. And if we just go through very quickly on some of our core values, it's firstly, I mean, safety first, you know, service before self, which talks to that we must be continuously trying to strive to exceed our customers' expectations, to be performance-driven, self-development, accountability and integrity, and to be non-negotiable, and the passion to actually do the job. Very quickly, in terms of actual, I mean, performance to date on some of the things that we've done, there was an issue around the aircraft and the number of aircraft that are currently being operated. At the point at which we got our AOC reinstated, we had two aircraft on our license. And just to be clear as to what this actually means, it doesn't mean there's anything wrong with the rest of the aircraft. But typically in the airline business, if an aircraft, even if it was fine and we were flying it the day before, if it then gets grounded for a certain period of time, there's work that needs to be done. There's maintenance work that needs to be done on that aircraft before it is deemed to be airworthy, I mean, once again. So we've been hard at work, working jointly with CAA to get more and more of our aircraft back on our AOC. As of the 22nd of November, we had eight aircraft on our license. By the 30th of November, we'll be up to 10 aircraft, and by the end of December, we'll be at 10. By the end of the financial year, we will have 15 aircraft back on our license. And just to be clear, we will have 15 of a total 17 aircraft that we intend to keep within our system. If anyone refers back to what I actually said initially, which is we used to operate 22 aircraft, those 22 included two aircraft which were short-term leases, which we said we can do away with, and there is one additional aircraft lease that we will be terminating at the end of January, because we want to make sure that we use our own aircraft for all operations, and basically we're trying to ensure that we increase the usage of the aircraft that we have. So we're quite focused on aircraft utilization and getting it to a good benchmark standard. I talked about OTP, and I think this here is a slide where it is sourced from AXA, so we're not trying to share information on competitors that we shouldn't. You know, it is available on the AXA, I mean, website. And just to actually demonstrate that we actually had a target of 90% on on-time performance, and we hit a target of 94%, and we are best in class now in terms of comparison with other airlines on those same routes. So it is a good story. Likewise, on our technical dispatch reliability, we had actually set ourselves a target of 98% to get aircraft out on time. That's what technical dispatch reliability measures, and we have been exceeding those targets and hitting 99% down to 98% in October. From a passenger performance year to date, as indicated, there were a number of routes that were operating prior to the grounding. As of when we returned back to service on the 23rd of August, we started with three routes, and to date the airline is operating seven routes already. And before the end of December, we will be introducing an additional 4 routes, which is Johannesburg, Port Elizabeth, Port Elizabeth, Durban, and a triangular that goes the other route as well. From a trend perspective, and we've just used the three routes that we started with when we started, you will see that, I mean, we're recording a very positive growth trend from a passenger number, I mean, perspective, or load factor, I mean, perspective. Lubumbashi was the first route that we returned back into. We started with a 44% load factor. We are now at a 72% load factor. And then in terms of flown versus booked, to say what does the picture look like, I mean, for going forward, you will see, I mean, from the graph that we are, I mean, picking up good bookings in comparison to what we have forecast for both the months of November and December. On that slide, we show you what has actually been flown to date as up until the 22nd, what is booked for the rest of the month versus what we had projected for the rest of the month, and likewise, what is booked already to be flown in December compared to what has been forecast for December. But we also say we just need to make the point. We are a typical business airline where 75% of our passengers are business travelers. And as a result, we'll see that in terms of in our booking curve, which is the number of days people book before they take a flight, that it's between 3 to 14 days. So we're not the type of airline where people book 4 months in advance, 6 months in advance, because that happens when you're going on holiday and so forth. So we are quite comfortable that we're tracking quite positively against what we are actually projecting. In terms of, I mean, our revenue performance, you know, to date, we started August on the 23rd of August, and we operated only 96 flights for that first month of August, which was only 8 days, and we were able, I mean, to record revenue which was just below 5 million. In September, the revenue increased, I mean, to around about 40 million, which obviously still is on the reduced schedule. And in October, we've already recorded revenue in the region of over 50 million. I think the question, I mean, always is like, what do we look like for the rest of the year? We are clear that, and it's very clear, with the grounding, with us taking a phased approach to return to service, meaning we're not operating optimum schedule at this point in time. We will only get to that point towards the end of this financial year. We accept that, unfortunately, we are going to be recording a significant loss, I mean, at the end of the financial year, looking, I mean, to record a loss in the region of 669. But in terms of our projections, and once we're on full schedule with the additional route rights having been implemented, we anticipate that in April 19, the organization will begin to break even. And if we remain on track as we are doing right now, once we break even in April, we are of the view that we would then be able to also record net profits for the next 2 years. I thank you.
Well, thank you for the presentation. I guess the best would be to allow National Treasury to present and then we discuss. Over to National Treasury.
I think we're just dealing with the technology for now.
Okay, meanwhile, you're preparing. Indeed, we must thank you, CEO, for the presentation. Indeed, it is igniting hope. Anyone who came in here having lost hope, I'm sure you can be positive now. Yes, and add weight to this turnaround strategy, which promises us also an economic booster. You may come in.
And Chair, just before she starts, is there a copy of this presentation for us?
They're sending it because I thought I was just going to talk to it, but I think because of the numbers, I asked them just to print a copy for the members.
So basically,
of this presentation?
They're bringing it, Chair.
Oh, it's still coming?
Yes, they're bringing it.
Okay.
So when we were here, Chairperson and Honorable Members, on Wednesday, you said to us we must actually explain why Treasury is proposing an allocation to SA Express. So we have listened to SA Express, they have presented to the Treasury, and as with other state-owned companies, they in a dire financial state. But the thing with SA Express, what we have looked at was the fact that they actually have guaranteed exposure. Now, if you look at what we have given them as guarantee, their total guarantee is $2.8 billion, the facility that they have, but the utilization as year-to-date is $1.249 billion. So the number that we're proposing that be allocated to the Department of Public Enterprises is basically the $1.249 billion that will be used to cover the government debt or the guaranteed debt. Now, why would Treasury propose such a thing? So we looked at the financial status of the airline, and we realized that over 10 years, the airline has not been making profits, and we looked at what they proposed going forward, and even their projections where they still expected to make losses. So what we looked at was, when will they be required to pay this guaranteed debt? And one of the maturities will be in November, and we were not so sure if the airline will be able to service that debt. Now, there's two ways in which the state can deal with government guaranteed debt. The first one would be you let the entity default, and then the borrowers come to the National Revenue Fund and they apply for their money, because the government, the guarantee conditions and as set out in the PFMA, they state that if an entity that has a government guarantee defaults, then they must come to the National Revenue Fund and it becomes the first charge in the revenue fund. So we can either wait for SA Express to default and then we wait for the creditors to come and apply for their money, or we can make an allocation to the Department of Public Enterprises as the mother department, and if and when SA Express is unable to pay for the debt, then the department can pay for the debt. Now, the reason why we didn't leave it to chance or to wait for the investors to come and ask for the money is because that makes us look not prepared, like we were not sure if what's going on in the financial position of the airline. But if you allocate the money, then it means you are aware of the problem. You know that there's a possibility that this airline will not be able to service its debt, and if that time comes, then it means there's money ready for them and you can allocate that money in an orderly manner instead of causing panic. So basically what is important, I think, for the members, especially from the Treasury point of view, is what are the conditions that are attached to this allocation. So the first condition is that these funds will not be used to pay any other debt than the debt that is guaranteed by the state, including the debt that is owed by the airline to Transnet. That is excluded, and that will not be utilized or will not be paid from this $1.249 billion. Then the second one is that the allocation, as and when SA Express pays the guaranteed debt, their guarantees should be reduced by the equivalent amount. So we will not be injecting money into SA Express and leaving the guarantee facility as it is. The guarantee facility will reduce by the amount of money that SA Express will be paying to their debtors. So what we require from SA Express and what we send through, of course, to the Department of Public Entity when we were giving them the allocation letter is we would need a monthly progress report on the utilization of the funds. So we want to know as the Treasury how much have they utilized, how much have they paid, so that we can make sure that their guarantees facilities are reduced. And also we would want to see a plan by the end of December from the department, of course, which for approval for cabinet, but mainly just looking at the optional cooperative structure of the state-owned airlines. So all of them together, whatever the plan is, I think it would be important from the Treasury perspective to know what is going to happen to, what is cabinet thinking in terms of all of these airlines. So those would be the very strict conditions that we have given, but mainly what is important is these funds can only be used to pay the guaranteed debt that they have used as the airline, and the fact that once we pay the debt, the guarantee facility must be reduced. Because if you don't reduce the guarantee facility, then it means SA Express can continue to borrow using the same guarantee facility. So in summary, Chairperson, that's the National Treasury position, and those were the conditions that we've given to the airline. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for, firstly, the overview by the Department of State Enterprises, the presentation by the CEO, which was indeed an insightful one, and as I've already put it, that indeed it is igniting hope, giving us hope, and I think the great excitement actually comes from knowing that experienced aviation experts have been appointed. There's a new board, and also we are promised an efficiently run airline. It's a promise. In Afrikaans, if you thought, I don't know Afrikaans over there, belofte maak skuld. It's a promise. All right. No, that's fine. But thank you so much. Honorable members, you have been listening carefully to these presentations. I'd like to open the floor for members to engage. Okay, let me take them. Okay, let me take the numbers of people first. To the Honourable Member Didier, Honourable Member Liz, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I'll take the first 5 hands and then allow the team that has come to present to us to respond and allow members follow-up questions, and if there are new questions, there'll only be 2 rounds. But each member should confine himself or herself to 3 questions so that we try and manage time better. In that order.
Thank you, co-chair. All the members, we received submissions from the FFC and the Parliamentary Budget Office on this special appropriation bill, which is very important. It emphasizes the oversight role of the National Treasury and the Department of Public Enterprises. And you will have to indicate to this committee in what way do you do that oversight. Secondly, Treasury on page 5, 1, 2, 3, the third bullet. SA Express has not indicated when financial sustainability will be achieved. In terms of your oversight, you should have known, you must know that, if through your engagements with this, with SA Express. You will have to clarify that, that statement, bullet number 3. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me say thank you to both SA Express and to National Treasury for the presentations today. Given what I had to say on Wednesday, it's a very welcome change. Thank you very, very much. And Caesar, I'm sorry I missed you on Monday, but I was made to feel very welcome. Thank you very much indeed. Madam Chair, three questions is quite difficult, but let me just try and narrow it down. we don't have a cash flow, so we can't really see projections except for the very brief income statement. But what is the current position? You're showing revenue of October of 51 or 52 million. What were the expenses? What is the cash burn? One of your problems in your problem statement, which existed in May, presumably still exists to a much greater extent even now, given the low number of aircraft flying, is the monthly cash burn. What exactly is it? So revenue in October was 52 million. What were the expenses? Are you discounting ticket prices to try and buy back market share as compared to your prices? If you get this 1.24 whatever billion, how are you going to fund the rest of your debt? You requested 1.74 billion. You're being told you're only getting enough for the guarantees. How are you going to fund the rest? Will those creditors push you into liquidation? Or have you got some kind of agreements with those? And if so, what are those agreements? The National Treasury... okay. I'm bowled over, actually, that you're doing to SA Express what you should be doing to SAA, but you're not doing it fully. You're withdrawing only 1.249 billion of the guarantees, not the full guarantees. So what's going to happen is Caesar is going to use the rest of the guarantees to borrow more money, and the taxpayer is going to be in the dwang again. Why are we not withdrawing all guarantees? But having said that, I'm absolutely thrilled that you're taking a small step in that direction. So there's compliments there. And then the last question for National Treasury, why is it necessary to get a monthly report on the use of these funds instead of simply getting a report that all debts borrowed against the guarantees is extinguished, get confirmation from the lenders, and that's the end. Why do you need a monthly report? Are you saying that they're going to use some of this money for operational purposes for a while, or they're just going to put it in the bank? Why would you do that? Why not leave it in the National Revenue Fund? Do you understand what I'm saying? Why, it sounds to me like you're allowing them to keep the money and only use it on a monthly basis to some point in the future. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chairperson. my angle of questions, Chair, would focus on not so much on the figures as my Midlands neighbour, Liz, has done, but. I'm hearing what the presenter is saying, that they are going back to the basics, but the basics are, well, perhaps generally yes, but, they didn't produce, when they departed from them for the past 10 years, they didn't produce the results. So let's hope that now the basics will then be relevant to produce the expected results or outcomes out of all the activities that they would be engaging on. And then the question is then why in amidst them not showing the profits very soon, but they are also planning to extend to the base. What goes into the base? Because I think they are saying that they are starting to open a second base in January and all that. So, it's obvious that there will be cost to opening more and more bases. Is it what efficiency, what efficiency would opening more bases help? to contribute positively to what we're trying to achieve. And then more clarity on your statement that you made is that you were operating with 22 aircrafts and you are reducing it. Are we sure that there won't be any capacity deficit? Will you achieve? You are saying that you'll achieve more with less, but I'm not too sure if you have detailed that you'll achieve more with less aircraft, or you know, it wasn't dependent on the aircraft. It was a bad decision to have more aircraft when the load is less, and yet you have to increase more load into the less aircraft. So I think if you could, clarify more for us, for me there. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Next, what you say? If you can introduce yourself so that, you know, I get familiar with your name. Okay.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks very much, Chairperson. My name is Dr. George, and I'm a member of the Select Committee. Thanks very much for the presentations. They were very, very useful, and obviously a lot of thought has gone into them. I really just have two questions, and one's to SA Express. I mean, you know, the problem we have over time, always, in Parliament, is that there's never, ever any accountability because the people keep changing. Now, of course, we'll now be dealing with a lot of new people and a lot of new executives. And hopefully we'll see a turnaround and everything will be wonderful and there won't be any problems in the future. But if it doesn't go that well, what I want to know is what accountability is there for the executives if it is not turned around? So, for example, if the performance is not what it should be, what consequence actually is there for those responsible for doing the turnaround? And then for the National Treasury, I certainly agree with your approach. I mean, you know, you have to think ahead. But, you know, also, Treasury, this keeps happening over and over again. And, I mean, the people's money just gets spent more and more and more, and it never really goes anywhere. And that's not okay, obviously, because the money all belongs to the people. Government doesn't have any money of its own. It all belongs to the people, to us. And you are the custodian. So I want to know from the Treasury is what steps you are taking. So, for example, obviously you provide the guarantee and that's done, etc., and then, of course, it gets called up. Now you're paying the debt because you've explained why, and I suppose that makes perfect sense. But what is it you're actually doing to make sure that you don't get into the situation where the debtors are, in fact, or the creditors are, in fact, coming rushing towards you asking for the money? So how do you have oversight to make sure that the people's money is, in fact, not getting wasted? Thank you.
Member Tobaza.
Thank you, Chairperson. Indeed, I must say that the briefing we've just received now does give us hope that the airline is in good hands at this point. However, I do want to just ask, what would you say are your biggest cost drivers in your operations? But also do indicate to us, secondly, the total debt that is guaranteed and the maturity dates thereof, so that as you recover, you also work towards meeting those deadlines. The last question, Chairperson, refers to slide 5, the second bullet. Chair, we are encouraged that in one of your slides, SA Express, you are showing upward trend in terms of your business operations. I just cannot place a finger on the slide that you showed us earlier on. But one is worried about what is being said in that bullet, that for the next three years you are likely to have losses exceeding 1 billion rand. So, to what extent are you speeding up, cutting your losses, so that by that deadline of 3 years, you are you have been able to curb losses to that extent? I mean, 1 billion rand is quite a big sum of money. Thank you, Chairperson.
I know you want to add something.
1 cent. So, Chair, just 1 cent. The Public Audit Amendment Bill was signed into law beginning of the week by the President. That gives more power to the Auditor General to zoom into irregular, fruitless and wasteful expenditure. Looking at the history over 10 years, are there any monies that can be recovered? Because people must be held accountable. If they took wrong decisions, it had the financial implication that led to this situation. So between the two departments and SA Express, can you reply to that, please? Thank you.
Well, I will then request for responses. And if you can assist us, I know we're running out of time, with short and pointed responses. Welcome, Advocate Jenkins. Thank you very much for attending. Over to you.
So thank you very much, Chairperson. Maybe just to start with respect to the questions about, there are several groups of questions about the oversight role of the department, and I'm going to speak a little bit for National Treasury because we do work alongside each other. From the department's point of view specifically, some of the key responsibilities that the department has is, well, more the minister has, is the appointment of the board. So the minister did undertake a very comprehensive process after his appointment of reviewing all of the boards in the department, of the entities in the department, and this has resulted in the appointment of the board. Not all of the members can be here today. You've got Dr. Leoka, who's a very experienced economist. You have also, as the chairperson, Ms. Trifosa Romano, who had worked previously quite some time ago at SAA. She has worked in government before. She has sat on a number of the boards of the SOEs. So you've got people, sorry, but you have got people like that with a lot of experience who are coming onto the board of the airline. And you can see the fruits that have come through in just the very short time that they have been on that board. The other key responsibility that the department has is around setting remuneration. And the committee may be aware, but there was, in November 2016, there was a revised remuneration guideline that was approved by Cabinet, and the department has been in the process of implementing it. So several of the entities had it implemented in the 2017-18 financial year, and in the case of SA Express, we will be looking to include it into the shareholder compact for the 2019-20 financial year. One of the things that it requires is that there be a number of gatekeepers set. Some of them are very basic things, getting a clean audit, but also around achieving the targets that are set in the shareholder compact. So that if the airline doesn't achieve the sorts of targets that have been set in the shareholder compact, then the executive will experience a very real impact in terms of their salaries. Possibly, it will depend on how the performance contracts are structured, and CESA may want to speak to it, there could be more severe consequences. Obviously, that then speaks to the point about how the shareholder compact gets set. We are in the process, as the department, of reviewing all of the shareholder compacts with a view to trying to make them more focused on getting the particularly entities like SA Express to be focused on the key things that are going to turn them around, rather than maybe some more peripheral things that could actually distract attention from the turnaround. Both and together with National Treasury, actually over for some time, we have had monthly meetings with the airline. There was a period just around the period of the grounding where, because they were very focused on executing the things that needed to be executed in order to get the airline back on track, that we didn't have a few of the monthly meetings. But that doesn't mean to say that we, I mean, that's not the only interaction. It's just normally we have a monthly report that comes to both the department and to National Treasury. We have an opportunity as the officials to review the report, and then we engage with SA Express around the meeting. So at least it provides for, at the very least, a monthly meeting with the entity. And then under the PFMA Treasury regulations, we have a similar process on a quarterly basis to look back over the quarter and reflect on the quarterly reports that the entity submits. But obviously that's not the only interactions that we have with the airline. So just by way of example, we have been having quite a number of engagements with them around the turnaround plan. And this speaks a little bit to the questions that have been raised by the committee about the uncertainty that was indicated in one of the bullets on National Treasury side about exactly when the financial turnaround would happen. Because in the process of engagement, we've sent SA Express back a few times to look at additional initiatives that they need to implement in order to try and fast-track the turnaround so that you're landing up with these sorts of projections that CESA has put on the screen today, where instead of having a very protracted turnaround plan, you're looking to have a turnaround within the next year. There's other support that the department and also National Treasury from time to time provide to the airline, which includes engaging with various stakeholders. In particular, in the current climate, it has been important to engage with the banks. From the department side, we have indicated the strategic importance of the airline. And I think I'll let CESA talk a little bit more, but we're anticipating that with the financial injection, if that is approved by the committees, that that would significantly improve the airline's credit metrics. We do anticipate that initially they would probably have to, unfortunately, Honourable Lees, use some of the remaining guarantee facility after the guaranteed debt has been repaid and the guaranteed facility has been reduced to raise debt. But as the airline continues to be profitable and with a sound balance sheet that it would have with the capital injection, in time it should be able to borrow without the support of those government guarantees. Maybe just to touch as well on the point about the reason why there would need to be monthly reports. Mumpal from National Treasury has indicated that there is debt that matures on the 30th of November. At this stage, just to be safe, we're engaging with the banks with a view to extending that just for a couple of months so that there's no issues with if Parliament approves it, that the cash perhaps potentially wouldn't be able to flow by the 30th of November, and we want to try and avoid the issues that Mumpal has raised around a disorderly fallout as a result of a potential default. But the remaining debt is staggered over a period of as far as 7 years out. So we will need to negotiate with lenders. We're looking at it as being a more optimal scenario to try and get the debt repaid up front because some of it is at quite high interest rates, and rather than to renegotiate facilities on the basis of a stronger balance sheet, on the basis of a clear commitment from government that it supports the airline, and so to refinance that debt. But it will need to have some engagements with the lenders. It's not all due and payable on the 30th of November, and so that's why we will be providing National Treasury with reports to demonstrate that as the money is repaid, what amounts are still outstanding, and what has been that the money has been applied as per the conditions. I think maybe just it's a very brief point, but we have already, in line with the conditions that Mampo has highlighted, we have already taken to Cabinet a proposal around an optimal structure for the state-owned airlines that Cabinet is still deliberating on. So we are confident that at least there will be a proposal that is in line with the conditions that National Treasury has attached that can be met by the end of December.
Thanks, Avril. Chair, from National Treasury's perspective, not to repeat whatever they've said, the one thing that we're looking at is basically the review of all the guarantees that we have, and we're hoping that we will send this to Cabinet as soon as possible. So one of the things that we're looking at basically would be us as Treasury not recommending issuance of guarantees for operational purposes, so the way in which we're looking at issuing these guarantees should basically be for capital projects only. Looking at the current stock of guarantees, the problem now that we have is that most of these entities use the current guarantees as for going concern purposes, but what we're proposing, which we hope can be approved, is that we relook at the existing stock of guarantees and we don't roll it over for entities that will be using it for operational reasons. We look at the perpetual guarantees. We must review all of those and make sure that where possible, if we think that the utilization of this is not according to the conditions that we have, then you just withdraw it from the entity. So most of those things we're looking at ensuring that these entities adhere to the guarantee conditions so that there's enforcement, and one of the proposals there would be these conditions should be attached or should be measurable, but also should be in the performance agreements of the SOC's executives, so to make sure that we can monitor if they adhere to these conditions. So these are some of the proposals that we're going to be putting forward to Cabinet, and we hope that these will help us manage the risk of the guaranteed portfolio that that we have. So the reason why we're not really withdrawing the leftover guarantee, as Avril said, is that we just want to make sure we're hopeful that SA Express can survive because of their projections and their new executive members. So we're hoping that they will survive without using the remainder of the guarantees. But if Cabinet approves the proposals to review this, even the SA Express guarantee that is left after the payment of the 1.249 billion, we will have to review it and we will have to let them know whether we think they should keep the guarantee or we will be withdrawing the guarantee. But that can only happen when Cabinet approves our proposal as the National Treasury. And this is just to make sure we strengthen and we minimize the risk of these guarantees coming back to haunt us, because it's not only SA Express that we have to deal with, but we have around over 350 billion of exposure, and we need to start looking at how we give these guarantees, why we give these guarantees, and how do we make sure that these guarantees are linked to capital projects where we know that once you issue it, the investment will pay for the debt rather than the state paying for the debt.
Honourable members.
Okay. My apologies. Just Anthony Julius from from the Assets and Liability Management section. Just in terms of the diagnosis that we've done on South African Express, that we've identified the weaknesses, and these weaknesses are essentially, you know, policy uncertainty, the dual mandate that exists. And so when you, on the dual mandate, you have this your commercial versus developmental mandates, and then when you have mandates that are not financially sustainable, you don't have the revenue that can finance, it becomes an issue. There are issues around the position of government. What is government's position with regards to the entity, so that there is no conflict and that there is a firm position that is taken. The regulatory environment is not very clear, so you have perhaps a conflict in the way that the transport sector is currently managed, where you have the department itself, Department of Transport, effectively being the regulator. So those are the issues. So these are the areas that we are looking to be seeing where the improvements are. The staff is bloated, and so you've got to see how the entity aims to be reducing the staff over time. But a big area is the oversight monitoring. And so when we've identified reforms, and we have communicated the current reforms already approved by Cabinet on the private sector participation, we'd want to see how and where in the corporate plan the private sector would be involved in the turnaround strategy, where the framework that has been approved on costing the developmental mandate, how that costing is being done so that we could understand what the costs are of the commercial or the developmental mandate, so that when the entity goes into a profitable position, that it is then in a position to have revenues to finance the developmental mandate. So these are the reforms that we would be monitoring and that we would be reporting on. And we also report very regularly to the committee on the guarantee exposure globally, the total portfolio of guarantees. We will also give very specifics on where there may be deviations from what conditions have been attached to the guarantees that have been provided to entities and South African Express in particular in this case. Thank you.
Responses? And honourable members, can you please look at your agenda?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry that we haven't had responses.
Okay, maybe this is the only part that I will allow, the follow-up questions, but I will not allow new questions. Instead, I would like members to submit those questions in writing to the Secretariat, who will then redirect those questions to National Treasury, if necessary, also to the State Enterprises Department. All right, follow-up questions?
Madam Chair, I think they're ready to answer the questions they haven't answered.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just going to deal because all of the, I think the rest have actually been dealt with, but some of the specific ones relating to the airline. I think there was also a question around, are we actually discounting ticket prices, to gain market share? No, we're not. What we are actually doing, it would be normal practice that as we start a route, there are always what we call introductory fares. But the way in which, airlines actually work is that they're buckets of fares. And it's really from a revenue management perspective that you actually try and manage your fares. If anything, we're probably going to be, I think that we're generating more than what we did, previously, because we've actually improved some of our yield management and pricing versus what we're doing before. I think for most, but it's from a revenue management perspective. You also asked a question about, in terms of the cash flow, the cash flow projection. We've been actually working on a number of scenarios dependent on when some of the liquidity would actually come into our space. So we have got a couple of scenarios, I mean, that we've been looking for. We are also waiting, I mean, to hear and to, from National Treasury, or to be given a sense as to what it is that would be allowed to do with the funds that have actually come in. So we had actually run scenarios where we say we will actually settle all of the historical, you know, I mean, debt, even that has probably not due, I mean, as yet, in order to allow us the room to be able to possibly finalize a new credit, I mean, a credit line, but just really just to support us in the event that we require it from an operational, I mean, perspective. So that was one scenario. But the other one was basically to say we settle what is actually due, you know, today, and then obviously because some of these repayments or debt repayments are staggered, we only pay as and when they become things. So the long and short of it is that we are working on a various number of scenarios, and because we're doing that jointly with the board and the Department of Public Enterprises, we actually hadn't actually finalized one position, because part of what we're going to be seeing is what comes out as part of this process. So I'm happy to share that in future, but just to give you the assurance that it is something, I mean, that we are actually, I mean, working on. Then, I mean, there was a question in terms of, I made the point that we're going to basics, but then we're talking about opening up a second base. What does that actually mean? When I talk about going back to basics, it's just ensuring that we go back to what SA Express was for, which is serving some of these destinations with the right level of frequency and ensuring that we're meeting the schedule that our passengers expect from us. What we started to do wrong in the past is that we began to want to be everything to everyone, which actually resulted in us spreading ourselves thin and going into markets where we were inefficient in offering one or two frequencies. The reason why I'm saying we're coming back, I mean, to Cape Town is because Cape Town as a base was a very good base, I mean, for us. But as we come back, we're coming back at the time when we already have enough aircraft to service the Cape Town base properly. Because if you don't have enough, I mean, aircraft, then you're not running an efficient, I mean, operation, because you must have, I mean, scale out of any particular base. So that's why we staggered it, I mean, to January. It obviously would help us, I mean, from a revenue perspective, but part of it is that it actually helps us to manage our costs, that we don't just bring in one aircraft that's going to do one or two frequencies. We bring enough aircraft so that we can actually benefit, I mean, from the scale of having, and therefore in that way managing our cost, because if we brought in only one aircraft, we'd still have the cost of a full complement of staff who are probably not being very productive. And, I mean, when we talk about staff, it's not only ground staff, it's also pilots and everything else. Hence the decision to only come back when we can actually demonstrate those efficiencies while we open up additional routes. There was a question around, I mean, accountability, and I think, I mean, our board member can also talk about that. But from a management perspective, one of the key things that we're really focusing on is consequence management and ensuring, I mean, that there is consequence management where if people were supposed to do certain things and they don't do it, we make sure that there is very strict consequence management. I did say upfront this is part of the reason why we found ourselves where we were, because people were supposed to do certain things that they didn't. And I think that what has been missing in the past is that we didn't have proper performance agreements in place that talk to what we need to achieve within the system. That is what we're actually focusing and implementing at this point in time. And then holding people accountable, because we need to actually sit guide where there is a requirement to guide, but where it's very clear that maybe people are just not doing what they should be doing. We also should be in a position to make the hard calls. And I think that as much as the grounding was a very unfortunate situation for SA Express, for me, it's been positive in the sense that everybody acknowledges that we cannot continue as we can. We have to change. And that is, I mean, at least the positive outcome out of the grounding. In terms of, I mean, what are our biggest, I mean, costs within the system, I did mention that, I mean, aircraft leases are a big element of our costs. Employee costs, a big element of our cost at this point in time. And I think a member from National Treasury was actually alluding, I mean, to that, is that part of what we need to do, besides what I've already mentioned, is ensuring that we also right-size the organization to in line with the number of aircraft that we have in the system today versus what we had, I mean, in the past. Fuel is a big element, and of course there are also very large, I mean, operational costs that actually pertain to the service that we require to operate the airline. But in terms of who, I think Avril actually spoke, I mean, to a number of the issues. Who do we actually owe right now? It's suppliers in terms of the split, in terms of legacy debt, and I think that we have made significant progress in reducing the legacy debt. And then the other group of people who, you know, who likely, I mean, you know, call on the guarantees are the banks, because a lot of that is actually as a, the guarantees are linked to some of the facilities that we got, I mean, from the banks. The due date for most of that is November of this month, and so we've already had to go back and try and have discussions with them just to give us, I mean, a little bit of, you know, of time, because the due date was November. Not all of it in November, because they are structured in such a way that there's some capital amounts that are due, I mean, in November, some capital amounts that are due next year, I mean, in February, and so forth. So they also tend to be, I mean, quite staggered. And the third class of people that basically would owe would be around guarantees around the aircraft leases that we have, which are a bit longer term. So also talk, I mean, to the issue that it's not so much about the monthly, I mean, oversight, but that there are certain things like, for example, once we pay the banks, I guess that's when National Treasury would come and say, we've now reduced your guarantees by so much, but some of them are actually linked to aircraft leases that are only due in at a future date. I don't know if I have then...
Madam Chair, there's just the question of the monthly expenses, the cash burn, and how are you going to deal with the difference between 1.2 and 1.7 round figures of debt. And just to clarify then with National Treasury, so if Parliament approved this, the full 1.24 would be paid to Public Enterprises, who would pay it to SA Express, but they won't use it to cancel debt until the debt becomes due, so they'll have money in the bank, which they'll presumably use for operational purposes.
No. Our CFO is here.
All right.
Hi, good morning. My name is Mposile. I'd like to address the issue of the cash ban, the monthly expenses. It's about 117 in total per month. But that is too prompt. You've got the operational expenses, which is about 97, and then you have your interest charge, which is about 10, 11. Unfortunately, with the restructuring of the debt, we will be in a position to reduce the interest charge in a sense that now the banks, because we are on a back foot, we are being charged about 12.75%. But when we entered into loan agreements, the agreement was such that we would pay JIBOR plus 3%, the margin of 3%, somewhere along the line 2.5%, which in on average would really add up to 9.75%. So now, with this back foot of us not being able to meet our commitments as and when, the bank come back and say, we are going to charge you the deferral and deferral interest plus the default interest. So I think with the 1.249 cash injection, we will be in a position to be negotiating these deals with the banks to say, go back to 9.75 or JIBOR plus 2% margin.
Please assist us then, because we've got these other public hearings. They also need enough time from us, but it's okay. I think you'll be the last one.
I just wanted to say that, just to remind Parliament that they have the right to give the conditions of how they see the money to be used by SA Express. So if our conditions are not sufficient, then Parliament has the right to add or take out these conditions that we've put forward as Treasury when you approve.
Okay. There's some deviation there. Okay, thank you so much for this engagement. Indeed, it has been very, very helpful. Honorable members, actually, he's a very difficult member, but as he opened his mouth, he welcomed the change. So you can see that indeed we are on the right direction. From a reduction of the legacy debt to an improved revenue performance from 4.7 million in August to 51.9 million in October. Members would agree that the presentation hit the right notes and ignited optimism. We welcome the appointing of the interim CEO. I still don't understand why interim CEO and why not appointment of a CEO. But the new board and skilled aviation experts, that in itself is giving us hope. We are pleased to hear that the team has started making headways in the following critical areas: reducing costs and improving efficiency, improving on-time performance and aircraft reliability. We are encouraged by this. And most importantly, the airline has improved safety and customer satisfaction. This has been a big challenge in the South African Express. Well, I'm sure members are pleased to hear that South African Express will return to profitability as soon as 2019/20. We urge the interim CEO to continue on this positive trajectory. You have our support. And I think also National Treasury support, you have it. But also, from where I'm sitting, I can feel that you also have the political support. But that is subject to close monitoring and oversight by both National Treasury but also the Department of State Enterprise. Lastly, we are pleased that there is strong collaboration between the Department of Public Enterprises, National Treasury, and the South African Express, South African Airways Express Board to improve sound governance and financial management. Now, you must know, with this information, we will be following on your expenditure reports and also following on whether indeed there is a successful implementation of this turnaround strategy. We might, in one of the quarterly reports, we might need you just to come in, give us a feel on whether indeed we are making this impact that you say you are making. Thank you very much. I'd like the meeting between ourselves, I think the meeting between ourselves ends here. We have received the responses from the questions that were forwarded to you in writing, and thank you very much. If members have not received those responses, I'll request our secretariat to circulate those responses to members, because there were questions that were forwarded in writing. And the meeting between ourselves stands adjourned. Honourable members, I'd like us to take just a 5 minutes human rights break. Okay. Because yes, the chairperson will allow him. There's a question that you did not answer, but you'd like to have that question to be responded to in writing.
Are there any monies that was lost because of irregular expenditure? Because your financial statements is outstanding in terms of the HE's general report, which I've got here on the table. How will you recover that? You can do that in the right thing to do. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. 5 minutes so that we allow them to walk quietly. Honourable members, if you have to stand up, John, and time, just 5 minutes.
From the head of administration.
I'm with my daughter, and he has got so much luggage. It was truly so. And I'm on British Airways. South African Airways is full. And I'm out of some
challenge.
Yeah, so I thought that should be now and try and put out for that.
No, we will give you permission.
Okay, bye-bye.
Well,
if
we
are
able to...
Oh, look at the thing. Now, what? I'm sick.
Never, no.
Members, please be seated. We are 36 minutes behind schedule. We're coming to the second part of our meeting, where we will now engage with stakeholders, making their submissions on the adjustment appropriation as well as the special appropriation bill. And we go immediately to the Budget Justice Coalition. Are they here? They are there, and I'm going to give you 15 minutes. If you can do it in a shorter time, it will assist us, because we've got the documentation, and we went through it already. Are you ready? You may start immediately. I'm going to time you.
Good afternoon, honourable members, and everyone else in the room. My name is Sibabalo Gulichana, and I'm from Equal Education, and today I'll be presenting the first half of our presentation on behalf of the Budget Justice Coalition. And just to give a brief background of who we are a coalition of about 20 progressive civil society organisations, who acknowledged that working to ensure substantive equality in our society is not possible without active engagement with and transformation of the budget, and that's basically the work that we do.
Sorry to interrupt you. Are you working from a slide presentation?
Yes, Chair.
Because we don't have that.
We circulated it and there are copies. Would you like me to get one at the back?
Members, it is this document. We haven't received this one. We're receiving it now. Thank you. You may proceed.
Okay, thank you, Chair. So just to give a brief overview of what we'll be talking about, I'll give a brief introduction, speak to some of the recommendations that we were put forward by the Committee on Social, Economic and Cultural Rights of the UN Committee, as well as findings and recommendations of the above-stated programs in relation to the appropriations bill in the 2018 NTPPS. So the NTPPS states a commitment to keeping government expenditure within previously stated expenditure ceilings, and this signals a certain level of control over national government expenditure, but could also reflect the absence of political will to cut spending in the system in the face of a looming crisis. It is unacceptable that the financial consequences of poor governance and corruption are being transferred to the citizens' realm. And after 2 years of engagement between civil society, national government, and the United Nations Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, has released its concluding observations in October 2018. These recommendations are as seen on the screen or on the presentation that you have. The first being that we need to review fiscal policy to improve its capacity to mobilize domestic resources required to bridge existing gaps in realizing socioeconomic rights, revise the provincial and local government equitable share formulas to improve equity in the allocations of resources towards the attainment of the government rights, assess the impact of the VAT increase on low-income households and implement mitigating actions when needed, re-examine growth model in order to move towards a more inclusive development pathway, intensify efforts to combat illicit financial flows, including measures to combat trade mispricing with multinational corporations, and lastly, austerity measures, often unavoidable but when implemented, should be temporary and only cover the period of the crisis necessary and proportionate and not result in discrimination and increased inequality. Now, to the first section on basic education. So the 2018 NTPPS mentions that after debt servicing, education is the fastest growing budget line item, but this statement is misleading. Basic education, in fact, is growing slower than it has been or in relation to other budget priorities and has continuously been revised downwards. The basic education government budget, according to the budget review for the 2018 financial year, was 20 billion less than what we had projected to be spending 2 years ago. And the way that we know this is by looking at previous NTPPS statements, which revealed that there are far less funds available to basic education than what was previously budgeted for. Considering this decrease in projections is concerning given the 1% VAT increase that was effected this year, which has meant that the cost of education provision has in fact risen while the department and the sector as a whole has less funding to work with. This table over here shows us what the MTBPS from 2016 to 2018 have been projecting on education spending, but as I mentioned in the previous slide, we're in fact 20 billion less than what we had said we'd be spending in 2016. Additionally, the decreases in the education budget can also be observed when we look at the nominal growth of the basic education appropriations as mandated by the appropriations committees. If we look from 2014 to 2015, the budget had increased about 9.3%. In 2016, it then dipped to 3.5%. In 2017, it increased slightly again, but when we look at this current financial year, there's been a significant decrease, and that negative growth of minus 2.9 that you see over there, in fact, means that we have less money in the system than we did in the year before. Additionally, what is more concerning than the decreased nominal rate of change is also noticing that the Department of Basic Education actually hasn't been able to effectively spend its current budgets. So this graph over here looks at the allocations or adjusted appropriations rather between 2014 and 2017. And as you can see, the yellow line has not in the last couple of years touched the gray line, which would signify increase or complete spending of the entire budget that is given to them. And when we look about or when we speak about budget expenditure, the department as a whole isn't able to spend its budget. That means that its grants, specifically school infrastructure grants, and here I'm referring to the SIBG, which funds the CD program, also for the past couple of years has also not been able to spend its entire budget. And the first column, which represents the allocated the allocation, is actually the adjusted appropriation. So in the beginning of the year, they'll receive a main appropriation, but due to their poor spending patterns, this allocation will be revised downwards, and even by the end of the financial year, we would have noticed that they haven't been able to spend that complete budget. This inability to efficiently spend allocated budget then affects how they perform against their targets. This here is their CD program, and these are the targets that they set for themselves for the last 3 years. Please note that the 2018 figures are for the first 6 months of this current financial year because it hasn't ended yet. And as we can see, between 2016 and 2017, the DBE was not able to meet any of its targets. Now, their CD program was initiated to try and increase service delivery in terms of school infrastructure, so that was speaking to schools built with inappropriate materials, sanitation, schools without water and electricity. And every single year, we have seen that they have not been able to eradicate this. So overall, our findings in the basic education sector has been that while allocations in the DBE have been increasing, the annual percentage growth rate is actually slowing down. They haven't been able to spend allocated funds, and spending in school infrastructure particularly has also been very slow. And they have been unable to meet their targets. And therefore, we have recommended that the Standing Committee on Appropriations, National Treasury, and the DBE need to work together to determine, first of all, which programs contribute to this underspending that we're seeing continuously, and how to mitigate further underspending, not only in the current year, but in next financial years, provide financial management support to the DBE and provincial education departments in order to encourage output-driven expenditure, because you know, spending money with no service delivery is pointless. Increased oversight on the CD program to ensure efficient budget expenditure, as well as monitoring performance to see that delivery targets are reached before the next norms and standards regulation, which is the law that regulates school infrastructure provision in the country.
You've got 5 minutes left.
going on to post-school education and training. Here, what we have seen is that higher education has also been the fastest growing budget line item after debt servicing. And with the announcement by the former President Jacob Zuma that higher education would be free in 2018, we have seen that there's actually been a spike in its provision. So this graph over here looks at higher education and particularly the funds that are given to NASFAS. And in 2018, you can see that there's been a 39.6% increase, but all of this has been without a policy. And part of the recommendations that we're speaking to is that the DVE, the DHEC needs, including National Treasury, need to develop a policy that speaks to the rollout of free higher education, and that with support from the DHEC, governance challenges with NASFAS need to be addressed.
Thank you very much, Comrade Chair, sorry. I think more broadly, given that our times are constrained, I think the spirit of our presentation is really around the protection and advancement of socio-economic rights. And what's really been discouraging about this particular MTBBS is that national political priorities don't seem to have translated into the way we budget. When it comes to health, we've had the release of the National Health Insurance Bill in June this year, but there's no provisions over the medium terms for any kind of system improvement to address the crisis within healthcare. Secondly, when we land, everybody's talking about land. When we look at the Department of Rural Development, there's no new strategies to accelerate or address some of the challenges that have been faced over the last 20 years. In social development, we
administratively disenfranchising or removing people from benefits with little statements like improved assessment leading to a 100 million rand saving, while we know at the end of that, or too low an uptake, which seems a little bit counterintuitive when we think about the economic conditions which we find ourselves in the country. And I think as the Standing Committee on Appropriations, who oversee the allocations of budgets to the department, I think we've got to a point now where we need to take a step back and try and understand why we continue to have these challenges in the spending of our money. The right to housing is central to the right to dignity, the right to health. Yet, when you look at the performance of the housing department, we have achieved basically a third of our own contracted targets around subsidized units, around units that are financing support for people who don't qualify for subsidies, and overall the and housing delivery, if you look at the graph over here, has actually been declining despite need. If you look at the city of Cape Town where we are now, the waiting list is 60 years long. You know, I think as we enter into the fifth administration of our democracy, we've been marking 25 years, it's almost hard to believe that. It's really difficult to understand why these basic and fundamental socio-economic rights are not being afforded to people. When we look at the issues around social development in particular, I think there's a need for the department to have a step back and start, or the committee to step back and find out from these various departments what are the constraints to them being able to effect their programs. I think we need an analysis as to why the Department of Social Development can say that they've improved their, what do you call it, assessment criteria to the point where people are not accessing the grant, and then secondly that their estimated demand is higher than what they think the expected demand is. It makes no sense when we look at the broader execution of the budget within social development. And I think as we move into these trying economic times, we must remind ourselves of the preamble of our constitution where we talk about the goal of government, right, is to improve the quality of life of all our people and to release the innate capabilities. The budget is an opportunity for the government to show its commitment to achieving those goals. Have we got more time?
We've got 1 minute left.
And I think I probably just want to take a moment to talk particularly around environmental governance. The budget doesn't match the strategic importance of that particular unit. If we look at the budget mix presented within the appropriations bill, more than 50% of the money within the Department of Environmental Affairs is committed towards expanded public works programs. A further 12% is allocated to management and salary, leaving only 30% available for the strategic and important work of protecting our constitutional obligations in protecting our environment for current and future generations. We urgently request the committee in its power as an overseer of the budget to request the Department of Environmental Affairs to start looking the extent to which they still fit for purpose. If we think about some of our more recent memories around the rehabilitations of mines and the likes, where poor oversight has resulted in some funding being misdirected elsewhere, I think we're sitting on top of an environmental crisis if we don't adequately resource these departments to do their work. Similarly, housing 20 years in, we cannot continue to register the kind of failures that we have over the last 9 to 10 years without seeding some kind of social discontent. You know, and we request the committee to respectfully ask the Department of Housing and National Treasury to investigate the various funding mechanisms, including conditional grants and the operations of provinces and local municipal authorities in achieving that mandate of making adequate and affordable housing available to people. Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation. Let your voice be heard. Kusatu, you've got your 15 minutes. The Select Committee on Appropriations has a way of conducting its oversight, calling the national and provincial departments, for example, on basic education, to appear before it. And that's how we monitor the spending, specific also on the conditional grants. Matthew, welcome. You can go straight into your presentation. 15 minutes to you.
Thanks very much, Chair and Co-Chair and members. Good morning to colleagues and comrades. Yes, my name is Matthew from COSATU. Thanks for giving us a chance to raise our concerns and proposals around the midterm budget statement. as well as the additional funding for SAA. I think, Chair, in short, we are disappointed with the medium-term budget statement. We really feel it's a missed opportunity, given the severity of the economic, governance, and fiscal crisis facing us as a nation. We think, without being alarmist, we're in the worst crisis we've been in since 1994, yet today, with the exception of the President, we lack the political credibility that we had at that stage. Chair, I think we really didn't get a sense of our way forward from the midterm budget statement from government. There are plans on the table, from the stimulus package, the jobs and investment summit plans, but we didn't get a fleshing out from the minister there. We didn't get a sense of how we're going to get ourselves out of this recession, back to economic growth, back to creating jobs, protecting jobs. We hear the various turnaround plans for the different SOEs, but we didn't get a sense of a macro plan from government of how to save our SOEs. Chair, we heard the minister wanting to protect the mandate of the Reserve Bank, and fine, we understand where he comes from, but we want to see the Reserve Bank mandate expanded to protect job creation, protect economic growth, in addition to managing inflation. Chair, I think we appreciate government's honesty around corruption, but again, we didn't get a sense of how much have we lost to looting, and we're still losing even. What's the plan to recover that money to stop the bleeding? What's our plans to arrest people, to see them put on orange overalls, to see the assets being seized? We really don't get a sense of we're moving with enough speed. We welcome, Chair, very clearly, as Kosar, to the two commissions of inquiries into state capture into SARS. But we're worried, Chair, that government has this weird way of managing money, that we're going to spend 400 million rand on two commissions. Surely we can be a bit more cost-effective at times. But we support the commissions wholeheartedly, unlike one political party. Chair, Chair, look, we have various proposals around corruption. We really want to see government moving fast around them. We want to see comprehensive forensic audits, not just of the SOEs, but provincial departments especially, of municipalities in particular, where the looting is really a mass activity. I think we support Parliament's calls for lifestyle audits. We want to see it being implemented, not just for politicians nationally, provincially, locally, but even supply chain officials, department HODs. I think, Chair, we want to see the role of the Chief Procurement Officer expanded and entrenched, and in fact to see Treasury, the CPO and AG having full-time staff watching in each municipality, each SOE, each provincial department on a daily basis what they're doing, but not to account to those departments, but to account to Treasury. Because really, the amount of bleeding we get reports of daily from municipalities, it's unbelievable. Chair, I think we welcome Premier Makuta's placing the West Rand District under administration. In fact, we think all the VBS municipalities, which are all on the verge of collapse, should be placed under administration. Otherwise, they may not survive the next 2 months, 3 months. I think we support government's expenditure ceiling, Chair, given the crisis we are in. But we're not convinced by the debt level projections. We've seen those projections being pushed back each year, and we're worried that in 2 years' time we'll be pushed back again, and then we're heading not towards just us moaning and groaning, but towards the IMF. And when the IMF comes in, Chair, they'll do things we like slash cabinet, fine. But they'll do things we won't like reduce pensions by 25%, slash the public service payroll by a quarter, sell all SOEs, and that'll take us to a depression, Chair. So we're very worried that we're not using this time adequately to turn the ship around. Chair, I think just to give you an extent of our fears and our amazement, Madupi and Kusile expenditure ballooned by up to 100 billion rand. Giyani water project went from 40 million to, according to the budget statement, 4 billion. Yet we don't see consequences. In fact, we are amazed as Kosatu why the then Minister of Water Affairs, who presided over the collapse, redeployed last night to environmental affairs. It's just there's no consequences. And, Chair, we can't just blame officials. Leaders need to take consequences. We're very scared, Chair, about PRASA. And the statement was quiet about PRASA. Yet the AG, a month ago in Parliament, says he's not sure if PRASA is still a viable entity. Now, we had the old trains that are too tall purchased by PRASA. Now we've got trains which are purchased or being built, fantastic, but the platforms are too low. And the cost is going to be billions of rands again. Yet we're saying workers pay more tax money, you know. Chair, we've got various proposals around ways to reduce wasteful expenditure, and I won't go into the detail because of time constraints, but I think we need to see leadership lead by example and reduce from the front. Groups of bloated expenditures at cabinet, provincial cabinets, mayoral committees. There's a worrying bill in Parliament now, Chair, that says we must increase the amount of full-time councillors at a local government level. Yet, 90% of municipalities are in financial distress. Just to give you one example of wasteful expenditure, Chair, in the budget framework, we are putting aside 12 billion rand to build 5 departmental head offices and our consulates in New York. And how can that be a priority, Chair? Yet the state is bleeding and in a serious life and death crisis. Chair, I won't go too much into the wage bill, except to say, look, our population was 34 million in 94. Today we're 57 million. The public service headcount has increased from about 1.2 to about 1.4 million. So I'm not sure, Chair, if we're saying that less teachers will better educate more children, or less police officers will better reduce crime, or less nurses will ensure shorter queues at hospitals. The ballooning has really been at the top level. I think there are ways to be smart about how to stabilize the wage bill but not impact upon service delivery. So, for example, in the police service, we can take that 110,000 police officers who are at head offices or at desk duty, deploy them to critical specialized units, deploy them to community policing. But we don't seem to know how to manage our funding properly, Chair. But I think, Chair, looking in short on the wage bill, willing to engage and to help government come to the right approach. So we won't slash what we need to fill, and we don't allow to balloon what we need to reduce. Chair, also one proposal, one issue on that. At the presidential job summit last month or 2 months ago, the president committed the state to no public sector and service retrenchments. Yet we now see the SOEs running left and right to retrench workers. Government is quiet. And if that is allowed to happen, Chair, it will basically poison future engagement between labor and government. And we're not sure, Chair, why we want to blame and punish workers, but it's not them who have looted the state or brought it to the verge of collapse. It's not workers who fly their spouses to New York at the taxpayers' expense. It's not workers who said we must build in Kandla and other things, Chair. Chair, yeah, I won't go into the PIC issue too much, Chair. It's more the Finance Committee. But I just want to say, Chair, one sentence on it, that it's a very critical bill to protect corruption, protect workers' pension money, the UIF, etc. The Finance Committee, your colleagues, have done excellent work in drafting a bill, yet we see efforts by government to delay this bill beyond the elections. And, Chair, if government is serious about saving money, reducing corruption, we would want to see them stop delaying the Finance Committee from filling its constitutional roles. Chair, look, on the SOEs, I think we do appreciate the various turnaround plans. We think there is a need for more comprehensive forensic audits, and we do appreciate the initial green shoots. I think maybe just to say we are very, very worried about ESCOM, above all SOEs. It really is the monster in the block, and its current debt levels are 400 billion rand, and its management's plans to increase it to 600 billion rand with no clear business plan to save ESCOM or to stabilize it. We think, Chair, that demands urgent intervention by government's leadership. You can't increase ESCOM debt levels if you have no business plan, because that will threaten the collapse of the state. 600 billion rand is simply unaffordable. Chair, I think maybe we were lucky to hear SA Express's turnaround plans, and I think for once we're getting some sense of hope around SA Express. But, Chair, I think on SABC and other SOEs, we really want to see Parliament also playing a much stricter role on the management. We can't afford to be sending workers into the unemployment heap simply because management has blundered. And maybe to give one kind of salient picture of SABC, the top 10 managers at SABC earn together 24 million rand. Yet we're not retrenching any of them. We want to retrench those freelancers, those ordinary journalists who make far, far below that. And that's across the SOE's, Chair. SABC is the testing scenario. Once it's SABC, next it'll be SAA, then it'll be ESCOM, then it'll be the public service. Chair, I'm not sure if, you know, all of my members are politicians. I'm not sure how would we convince workers to vote for the ruling party if we're retrenching them, to be very blunt, Chair. So, Chair, you know, I'd always be a bit blunt with members, but you will indulge me. Our members are much more angry. Chair, we support the SAA appropriation bill. We believe it is a viable entity. There is a business case to be made for SAA. The Cape Town Joburg route is one of the 10 busiest routes in the world. As recently as 6 years ago, SAA used to make a profit. It plays a role around bringing tourists, even a role going forward around transporting working class people from different provinces to get them off the roads where they risk life and limb. But, Chair, we believe the issue of SAA has been an issue about mismanagement and about looting. We want to give the new team chance to fulfill and implement its plans. We see some initial green shoots. And I think, Chair, just lastly on SAA, we are disappointed by Minister Mboweni's comments. Government must lead by example. And we can't appeal to people to invest in the state if we're busy rubbishing it in New York. But we appreciate the President's comments. We appreciate Comrade Pravin Gordhan's comments. And we want to give the team time to save it. And also we want to hold that team accountable to reduce its own wasteful expenditure at management salaries and to save workers' jobs. I think I've got 4 minutes left, Chair, that the clock is right. Around SARS, Chair, I think we want to appreciate the Commission. We want to appreciate the President's firing the Commissioner of SARS. It's long overdue. We appreciate the initial green shoots around turning SARS around, and really that is the epicenter of the collapse of the state. We hope they won't see future problems in SARS. We really need to see them focusing much more on customs evasions, customs fraud. You know, for example, Chair, we used to get about R1 billion in customs collection for clothing imports. That collapsed to about a few five million rand in the past few years. So you can see the impact it does upon industry. Chair, I think we're also quite disappointed and shocked that half of the VAT hike has gone to paying back VAT refunds. It's just shameful in the least. Maybe lastly, around Chair, on SARS, they also need to come to the party around wasteful expenditure. You can't have the HR manager, whatever his title is, giving a bill to SARS of almost R1 million for his appearance before the State Capture Commission of Inquiry. It's immoral, to say the least, Chair. Such people should be fired. In fact, Chair, we think people like the former Commissioner of SARS should actually be tried and charged with economic crimes against the state. Because it's because of people like him we've had the VAT hike. Chair, around the VAT issue, I won't bombard you too much around it, but just maybe 2 points. I think we really feel we are taxing workers and the poor for the failures of government. We are suffocating workers and the economy. I think we would want to appreciate Parliament passing that provision in the tax bill this week, that there's a 3-year review of the VAT hike, and we think that's excellent work by Parliament. Chair, we've had also, I think we appreciate the VAT report by the Standing Committee on Finance, that government needs to look at a targeted expenditure to help the poor. We are engaging with the ANC and government around it, and we want to see in the budget next year an increase of 25% in the free water and electricity for indigent households. That would cost about 1.8 billion rand, which we feel is affordable, but that would help the poor. We welcome the flour and the sanitary exemptions, but we don't feel that's enough to really help the poor. In addition, we've got additional proposals around VAT relief, such as school uniform vouchers, etc., Chair, locally produced poultry and so on. Chair, the last 2 slides, and I think I've got 40 seconds, we're engaging with government around the carbon tax and the sugar tax. We accept the health promotion objectives of it, but we don't feel government is engaging with us seriously around a just transition towards it that will protect jobs and, in fact, can grow new economic centers. So it's fine for government to tax, but other economic departments must come to the party around protecting jobs. Lastly, Chair, and I know I'm running out of time, so I won't go into the specific departments, but in our last 2 or 3 pages of our original submission in this last slide, according to the midterm budget statement, these departments, water, energy, social development, agriculture, etc., have only achieved between 10% and 25% of their own targets for the financial year. So we're not sure what's the point of us taxing people, allocating money to departments, and they can't even meet their own targets for eradicating the bucket system, to deal with toilet crisis at schools, distributing food parcels, or advancing land reform. So we're really making a mockery of taxpayers to say we're taking all this money, yet it's okay for Water Affairs to meet less than 10% of its targets for the year. It's okay for us to continuously push back the eradication of bucket toilets from 2004 now to 2018, 2020, whatever the target is. So I think that's in a nutshell, Chair. I know you're very strict on time, so I'm going to end there, Chair. And thank the committee for giving us space to raise our issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Fukushatu. Next Wednesday, the 28th of November, the Select Committee on Finance will have public hearings on all the tax laws amendment bills. You are also welcome to make your submissions there. Thank you. We go straight to UNICEF. Give you your 15 minutes. The rebuild of SARS is crucial for South Africa. And we support that program wholeheartedly. We want them to succeed. So if you're ready, you can start.
Okay, thank you.
Introduce yourself.
Chair, let me introduce myself. I'm Sanjay Wijesekera. I'm the country representative of UNICEF. And to my left is Russell Wildermann, and he's the lead on social policy at UNICEF. We also have our chief of communications, Sudation Reddy, in the room. So
welcome to you.
Chair and honorable MPs, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for giving us this opportunity and privilege to be here. As you know, we are a United Nations Children's Fund, an international organization with the mandate to promote and protect the rights of children everywhere, and we are privileged to have been associated and have a deep relationship here in South Africa for a long period, including as part of the United Nations, being part of the international solidarity against the apartheid regime, as well as supporting you since the advent of democracy. So wonderful to be here. Thank you for that. I also wanted to start by making the point that a lot of what I'm about to say, and I'm going to be very brief because of your time constraints, but it comes from deep analysis of the budget that we undertake every year, from the perspective of the impact on South Africa's children, and we've taken the liberty of leaving some of that analytical work at the back of the room. So what I would like to do in the interests of time is to just go through three core messages, if you like, and then six recommendations. And this is complementary to some of what was presented earlier, so I can be quite quick. My colleague may want to elaborate on one or two of these points. So the first thing to say is that over the last 6 years there have been downward revisions of budgets, and that's had mixed impacts on children. So at times the spend on children has been protected, but at other there are also examples of where the spend that would benefit the poorest children has actually suffered as a consequence. So this budget policy statement 2018 is the first one where there appears to be an end to the centrally prescribed or driven cuts. But what that does do is that it passes on to departments, to spending departments and provinces, to make the difficult decisions on the trade-offs. And I think that has its own consequences, which means that it has to be monitored, well monitored, and well managed. And we'll address that in our recommendations. So in spite of, the second point I have is that in spite of a kind of a general fiscal austerity climate that we're all aware of, we do see that there is some fiscal space for the government to meet its priority expenditures for children, and that this will continue actually to on an upward trend, albeit at a slower rate. So the fiscal space for priority expenditures on children actually did grow, partly because of efficiency savings in some departments, and partly because the government itself, which is encouraging, has shown a commitment to meeting meeting these obligations. And then thirdly and final, the key observation is that there is a growing record and examples of where departments and provinces have innovated and improved efficiencies in their spending. However, this is going to have to grow, given the first point that I made, that a lot of the key trade-offs and decisions on cuts may have to be made internally by departments rather than it being centrally prescribed. So with that, let me move on to our key recommendations. And at this point, just to say that we have taken a lot of trouble to make sure that these are quite detailed. So if you excuse me, they're quite technical, but they are very hopefully detailed and can be considered for implementation.
As it's a very important. Thank you.
Thank you for recognizing that. So the first of six recommendations is that provincial governments should develop medium-term plans, particularly around education, health, and social development, for the gradual elimination of spending arrears. Now, again, it may sound like a very technical point, but we notice in our analysis that spending arrears is having a big impact both on government in terms of its ability to plan and deliver on service delivery, as well as on service delivery organizations, because they obviously if their payment is delayed, then they struggle to offer the services that are required. So there has to be a clear commitment to enforce the government's own benchmark for paying service providers and a plan to see those arrears being addressed. The second recommendation is that priority programs such as violence against women and children that are funded through the equitable share of the provincial allocation of the equitable share should be reported on in annual budgets. And this is respecting the autonomy of provinces to use the equitable share as they deem fit and how they prioritize it. However, if things like violence against women and children are indeed national priorities, it may not be unreasonable to expect reporting against money spent on them, but also on the outcomes against these priorities. The third recommendation is around the health sector. So the health sector has done very well in terms of achieving efficiencies whilst protecting some core non-negotiable items. However, this has been done largely by postponing investments in infrastructure. And our recommendation is that we need to re-engage and look at that because, of course, postponing expenditure on infrastructure cannot be done indefinitely, and that starts affecting service delivery eventually. And it is a good time to now look at that balance and trade-off that has been made, and also to urgently address kind of supply chain management problems that are the cause of poor spending in provincial health infrastructure, and I think that was alluded to by previous speakers. The fourth recommendation is to urgently improve the take-up of the child support grant among infants and very young children, and we do note, again, errors of exclusion, particularly among in the first couple of years. And perhaps if we link the kind of registration of newborn children to providing support to parents and caregivers on how to apply for the child support grant, I think that would be a good way of making sure that these errors of exclusion are addressed. And of course, as we know, the child support grant has a huge beneficial impact on children, their nutrition, their education, and their families. Fifth recommendation is that the financing of the school sanitation program should be fully implemented, and education planners should carefully balance spending on school sanitation and other parts of school infrastructure budget. But also, I think I would go further just to say that we should look at some of the unit cost models for school sanitation and look at how these unit costs may be controlled and how there might be innovation that will help to bring down these some of these unit costs. And certainly drawing on from my previous experience before coming into this post internationally, I think there is potential, particularly given the vibrant environment in South Africa in terms of both private and public sector solutions, that there is potential perhaps to look at innovation to drive down unit costs in this specific area. And then the final recommendation is that transfers to non-profit organizations or frontline service delivery organizations have suffered in both national and provincial governments, leading to recurring underspending, which again we've mentioned, we've heard about. So the government should expedite the new NPO financing framework and report on progress in implementing the provincial equitable share funding set aside for this purpose. So important details such as the actual amount of money spent should be reported, and we should also focus on outputs achieved and kind of promote results-based financing. It's worth mentioning that quite often in social services, the frontline service delivery organizations are a real lifeline, or the services they provide are a real lifeline to the most at-risk children and their families, and that having some kind of reliable and predictable funding model for these important functions is critical, and there are instances where at-risk children fall out of the system and because of lack of the predictable funding on this. So I'll conclude on the recommendations there, and if time allows, let me pass you on to Russell. Okay, so that's great. Russell Wilderman, who can elaborate a little bit more on one or two of these points. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sanjay, committee chairs. Just on the spending arrears situation, just historically, around 2008, I think in a PIFA report, South African spending arrears as a percentage of total government spending was about less than 2%. Now, if you look at Budget 2017, National Treasury raised the issue that spending arrears constitute a form of a hidden fiscal a deficit. Then if you look at the Auditor General reports, basically, it consistently refers to spending arrears in departments and how it actually makes it difficult for departments to consistently execute on their commitments, basically. Because what spending arrears are, it's essentially you have a financial obligation, the due date for when you should settle that financial obligation has passed, and now you're in a situation where more than one entity or entities are competing for payments that need to be done, and it completely complicates service delivery. So just to further elaborate on that, I think we need a complete statement, a quantification of the extent of the spending arrears, whether that be done provincially or nationally. We also need, in a sense, a verification of these spending arrears, because some of these claims are fraudulent. And therefore, there needs to be a process where these claims are validated. So for everyone to get a sense of what is the composition of these claims, is it on service providers, supplies, is it salaries, is it pensions, what is it basically? And then we also need to have a sense of the vintage. Vintage by vintage, it's meant the age of the arrears. It's 12 months, less than 12 months, more than 12 months, and so on and so on. Then we also need a plan that prioritizes, that lays down certain criteria. Who are we going to prioritize? Is it going to be for socioeconomic reasons? In other words, we don't want companies to go under. Is it because of reputational risk to the state? Is it because of risk to service delivery? And those prioritization criteria must be clearly specified in a plan to deal with expenditure areas. And finally, they must be liquidated. Because if they're not liquidated, then you always will have a suspicion if you look at some of the broader fiscal numbers that you're not sure if these numbers underestimate or understate the extent to which we have difficulty. So this is a key issue because it impacts directly on service delivery chairs. On the other issue around NPO, non-profit organizations that Sanjay ended on, this is a key issue, basically, but the difficulties lie on both sides of the equation. On the one hand, you have NPOs that do not comply, and it makes it difficult for government to move resources to NPOs in such circumstances. Sometimes there are onerous media monitoring and evaluation burdens, but sometimes government explicitly decides not to transfer resources to NPOs. And NPOs are on the front line of services for women and children. So if you don't prioritize NPOs, if you don't deliver consistent and reliable resources to them, then you're literally affecting the very same people that we want to reach. So the Department of Social Development is in the process of expediting, of finalizing the NPO financing framework, and hopefully that framework comes into place as soon as possible. Government has set aside money to deal with this particular issue, so this is an important issue. And just finally, the NPO financing issues actually contributes and continues to contribute to underspending across national and provincial departments. And you can't underspend during a time when resources are at a premium. Chairs?
Done? Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm also a bit frustrated. I would have liked that we spend more time per presentation. But to the PBO, Nelia, if you could zoom into this. UNICEF. They highlighted a couple of issues. Thank you to UNICEF. Just one thing about NPOs. They have to submit financial statements to get the next allocation of funding. If they don't do that, they won't get that allocation. That's how it works. It's about the accountability. The Rural Health Advocacy Project, University of the Witwatersrand. Over to you, sir. You've got your 15 minutes.
Chair and honourable members, you know, the right to health is one of our fundamental human rights. It's enshrined in our constitution and it applies to everyone, whether you live in the city.
Sorry, your name?
Okay, sorry.
Because it's not indicated yet.
It's right at the end there, but my name is Russell Rensburg. I'm a program manager with the Rural Health Advocacy Project, where I'm responsible for health systems and policy. Again, you know, I think the introduction of the Minister of Finance and the tabling of the medium-term budget policy statement, where he invokes Dickens and he talks about the best of times and the worst of times, is a particularly apt one for this year. I think over the last 9 years, we've definitely experienced the worst of times. And sadly, as we enter the good times, we are reminded of just the cost of what the last 9 years has given us. Now, the leadership transition in the governing party has brought new optimism. You know, there's been a greater level of responsiveness and transparency in a couple of months of this year. But at the same time, as we start opening up about some of our challenges over the nine years, some of the brutality of the honesty, particularly around the State Capture Commission and other commissions, of the extent of governance failure rests very poorly with communities like ourselves. And I think the significant failures in the intergovernmental fiscal arrangements particularly have contributed to the near collapse of the health system. And this is now widely accepted and no longer disputed. And I think maybe just to reiterate, like, what is the crisis? The crisis, again, like as our colleagues from UNICEF suggest, is that hidden deficits or wasteful and irregular expenditure continue to grow. You know, interventions are focused on financial management, but the problem hasn't been with financial management problems. It's rather been a leadership and governance failure and the oversight in the spending of money. Growing accruals amounting to 14 billion remain unaddressed and continue to impact on service delivery. Human resources for health, despite accounting for 65% of provincial and national budgets, remains a challenge, and staff with continued staff shortages and freezing of posts. You know, despite some successes with our drug distribution, the system continues to struggle with drug stockouts, from ARVs to contraceptives, which are necessary for women to maintain their reproductive rights. And in this context, the health budget even declined, despite health being a significant priority for the governing party, with over 350 million lost over the next 3 years. Some reprogramming of existing funds to address immediate priorities is welcome.
However, you know, the extent of these reprioritizations also begins belief in some sense. The NHI bill that was published this year is a good step in the reform of the way we deliver healthcare and we think about healthcare. But sadly, there's no commitment in the medium-term budget policy statement to funding any of the interventions or the priorities to support the implementation of the current phase. Instead, as I indicated earlier, budget reductions are being effected. Despite significant governance failures, Inspector of Health in a number of provinces, I mean, thinking KZN, the Northwest, and Free State, there's no attempt to address this through the introduction of new measures or support programs within the MTBS. Sadly, all of these provinces have large rural populations, and the loss of funds significantly impact on the quality of health services accessed by rural populations who bear the disproportionate burden of management failures. Now,
Thank you, sir. You may continue. You'll get 30 seconds extra.
Thank you, Comrade Chair. Honorable Chair. Again, you know, access to health is a fundamental right, and I think we protect it in our Constitution under Section 27, and even prior to the advent of our democracy, in the early years of our transition, we assigned up to the International Covenant on Socioeconomic Rights, which also recognizes the right to health. We invest significantly in our health programs, with over 12% of our national budget being allocated to health. And over the next 3 years, our consolidated health budget is the princely sum of 724 billion rand. It's a lot of money. 85% of this is transferred to provinces through equitable share and a number of conditional grants. However, what we've seen recently is that poor leadership and governance in provinces places a number of these investments at risk. A nice example of this is, for instance, is now the infamous Mediosa challenges that we've had in the Northwest, in the East, and in the Free State, where funds that would address needed healthcare services in the rural communities were redirected towards the enrichment of a few politically connected individuals.
We're going to recover that money.
And until we do, there's a massive hole in our budget. Right? In respect of, you know, so I think the point is not a financial management issue, it's a poor leadership and governance issue and an expression of the intent of our various statutes that try to control that. In respect of rural areas, costs are generally higher, and because the areas are less dense and cover large geographic areas and rugged terrain, it requires in additional investment. Instead, we have it less. But I think in your the positionality of the Standing Committee on Appropriations is such that we can no longer just expect provinces to do the right thing, and what is needed now is for provinces to start to actively report to this committee and others about the various differences in the implementation context and how that impacts on their budgets and how they plan for it accordingly. I think I've been here before and I've spoken many times around the issue of addressing the vacancies within the health system. Currently reported there's anything from 37,000 to 40,000 vacancies in the health systems. Rural facilities face a number of constraints in recruiting and retaining healthcare workers. In addition, this results in facilities being often understaffed, and the situation is compounded by ongoing freezing posts. And because they're out of sight, and they're out of mind, and they're not close to the Twitterati and the newspapers, these issues are seldom reported. The recent intervention to redirect 350 million towards priority posts is welcome, but given the enormity or the quantum of the vacancies within the system, it's unlikely that 350 million will do anything to address the crisis in health. If we look at the average salary of a medical officer, which is around 750,000 rand, those 350 will merely employ maybe 350 doctors or so. What is needed to address the crisis is a rational approach to understanding the extent of the problem. And we request this committee to request the National Department of Health to submit an analysis of the human resources for health distribution by profession, level of care, district and provinces, so that we can begin to understand what is the extent of the shortages and which communities are most impacted by these vacancies. I think in the absence of that information, it's difficult to see how any intervention will help us. Additionally, the National Department of Health must also develop a prioritization process to ensure that the vacancies that are filled are done so on the basis of need and adequate prioritization of underserved rural communities. Rural infrastructure inequity. I think we've spoken before about David Stukler's study. We spoke about investments following where the infrastructure is. In our country, that means that there's a disproportionate amount of money that's spent on urban areas because existing capacity is there, the hospitals, the clinics, and so forth. This results in underdeveloped rural districts, particularly those in so-called former homelands, receiving less investment than is required. Over medium term, over 20 billion is allocated to health under the health, various health facility revitalization grants. This includes the indirect NHI revitalization grant. And I remind you that the last time I was here on appropriations, I'm sad to report that once again that hospital revitalization grant has underperformed, really just achieving 30% of their targets and spending 100% of their budget. So there's something drastically wrong in the way we manage hospital infrastructure. A new approach is needed, and we strongly recommend that Parliament, through this committee, request National Treasury to compile a detailed overview on the performance of these grants over the last 9 years, highlighting the extent to which projects stayed within projected costs, and also we heard earlier about the overruns on Kusila, and it's not totally removed to think that hospitals will be paying three times as much as what we're budgeting for. Additionally, the NDIH must provide a comprehensive list of projects and engage in a process that prioritizes fixing existing infrastructure. And then given the transition to the NHI, where we will have access to all health resources, we should prioritize rural facilities, as these areas are largely served by the public service with little or no private sector presence. Health, you know, at the end of the day, if you want to manage a budget, we always require good information. At the moment, there are more than 42 health management information systems operating within the National Department of Health. Experts at the recent presidential health summit spoke about 27 of these being completely redundant and not fit for purpose. You know, there's even suggestions that by reducing these redundancies, we can save up to 2 billion rand, which is much needed to improve other aspects of the health system. And currently, there's no publicly available information to assess these claims, and neither is it detailed with in-department expenditure reports. As such, neither the Parliament or this committee or the public at large can make any decisions on the efficacy of these investments. We request that the committee should request the NDOH to submit a detailed analysis of current investments along with an assessment of the functionality of current systems, so that as we are in these resource-constrained environments, we can make the correct investments in the right areas. Now, I think there's a ton of other things that we can talk about the health system at the moment, but I think we can take advice from a recent paper in health policy and planning that looked at the Ebola crisis in West Africa. One of the challenges that got exposed in that crisis is that because we're so reliant on program funding, when a crisis either external or internal hits, there are three critical areas that we need to be able to have good insight into so that we can make the appropriate and correct responses. The first of that is an understanding of health financing. Right? At the moment, we have, by all accounts, a very inefficient health financing system through the conditional grants and the provincial equitable share, where not enough is done to protect allocations for health. The second one is human resources for health, having the right personnel at the right level to ensure that we meet the requirements of our population. And then finally, we have to look at health information systems so that we know what we can measure, we can manage. And I appeal to this committee to look at the recommendations and get the various departments to give us those reports so that we as a society can crowd solve this problem
and protect and advance the right to health for all South Africans, not just those living in cities. Thank you very much for your time.
Mr. Ensberg, just a request. You refer to a few matters now as a recommendation. Can you prepare a paper to go into a bit more detail?
I did.
If you have it, give it to the secretariat, please.
Certainly.
Because that will assist.
Thank you very much.
Now, thank you very much for your presentation. We go to Fair Play. Fair Play, are they here? Excellent. I'm going to mention that. What is it? Can you just sit, sir? Oh, my lord, yeah. While Fair Play is getting themselves ready, honorable members, we also received a submission from Dr. Sean Miller. We all know him. He's not here, but he submitted, and then a Mr. Knott. So that is also part of your packs. Fair Play, you may proceed. 15 minutes to you. It's a very healthy chicken, that.
Chair, thank you so much for the opportunity to be here. Fair Play considers this another opportunity to check whether Parliament is indeed listening to the views of people, especially after we felt that in the MTBPS, the concerns of people were not adequately considered. If there are two things that Fair Play wish for you to take away from our presentation, then it is, one, we do think that there is a case for chicken to be included in the veterinary basket. And the second thing that we think is important for you to take away is that after 27 years with the current veterinary list, Fair Play will continue its call for a comprehensive and thorough review of the current veterinary list.
Can I just pose one request to you?
Yes,
also,
sir.
Send this presentation to the Secretariat of the Select Committee on Finance for our hearings next Wednesday.
Sure. Fair Play notes that the MTBPS is done in difficult economic and fiscal conditions against the backdrop of a technical recession and economic expectations have not materialized. South Africa's growth forecast has been revised downward, and growth is expected to recover gradually to over 2% in 2021. Full year tax collections are expected to be 27.4 billion less, of which 20 billion reflects increased VAT refunds and 7.4 billion reflects lower corporate tax and personal income tax. Sanitary pads and flour will be zero rated, and revenue loss associated is estimated at 1.2 billion. While we understand the above, Chair, the needs and demands of the poor and poorer households have not sufficiently been addressed by the MTBPS, according to us. Therefore, we call for a complete and comprehensive review of the current zero-rated list, and this has not been done in these difficult economic times, to see where there can be possible savings through the elimination of certain products and the inclusion of more relevant products and products that are more accessible to the poor and consumed by poorer households. Chair, we are of the view that once this is done, we will be able to, one, look at possible savings to the fiscus, not only through VAT, if products like canned sardines and dry beans are reconsidered due to its dependence on imports. And then it also has the potential to improve the income if the focus remains on locally produced products. Then also, a consideration of the list will also result in the creation and the protection of jobs, or that is a key requirement according to Fair Play. So, Chair, currently, as you know, that there are products on the list that are highly dependent on imports, and therefore we do think that it is time over the 27 years that we need to review the list.
zero-rated list does not adequately address the nutritional concerns such as stunting, malnutrition, and the dietary and consumption needs of the poor. And chicken, Chair, remains a popular source of meat protein for poorer households, and its exclusion from zero rating would continue to be at the detriment of the poor. Chair, we also understand that this matter of the inclusion of chicken is a poor issue, poorly handled, though, by the Department of Finances. Lower-income households benefit the most from chicken. The benefits outweigh the cost. Nutrition is the best nutritional option, and there's fair value within chicken. Then I want to stand still at this slide. Chicken is a staple of lower-income households, the largest staple protein for low-income households, and it's not a luxury but a necessity in the diet of those in poorer households. More zero-rated food items purchased by the poor, nearly half of the food spending goes to VAT-free items. Chicken is South Africa's most popular source of meat protein, and chicken consumption has doubled since the year 2000, and more is spent on chicken than on mealie meal, brown bread, rice, or beef. South African consumers are under pressure, and the poor is hit the hardest. There are no zero-rated meat items, and targeting food items help reduce the regressive effect of VAT on the poor. I also, Chair, it would not be fair to us on this Black Friday and on this Friday to labor the issue of the nutritional value of chicken. But that is why I said that if there are the two things, then I think I have made the point, Chair. It is indeed important that for the last 27 years, and to do justice to the poor, that we do need a thorough review of that list so that we can then also look at the benefits to us. Malnutrition is a national priority, and we do understand, Chair, that with 1.58 million South African children under 5 that are stunted and 30.4 million South Africans that are living in poverty, we do think, Chair, that if we include chicken in the VAT-free basket, that we might just help to address these two concerns. Then, if you look at the lifetime cost of stunting, Chair, again, this is a matter that is very close to our heart. We do think that we will be able to deal with child mortality, IQ scores, income, and the economy. Chair, I'm just looking at slides to save our time because at the end of the day, I wish for a much positive income outcome out of this. And if you look at the benefits of chicken, then you would see that it has the best cost-to-benefit ratio. The cost to the fiscus is recoverable because it would result in 11,000 new jobs, 1 billion in tax revenue, and around 4 billion to GDP. The economic benefits are widely distributed, and reviewing the current basket of zero-rated items will produce savings. We can afford debt-free chicken by fighting corruption and illicit trade that evades revenue collection. Chair, therefore, we agree with the others. I just want to get to the last slide, Chairperson. Hold on just 1 second for me. We do think that it was a mistake to exclude chicken from being zero-rated, despite the fact that during the public hearings on the matter, NGOs and others were in support of this. Ignoring the calls by civil society organizations and the needs of the poor presents government as insensitive to the needs of the poor. The benefits of VAT-free chicken, particularly for lower-income households, are overwhelming. It is South Africa's most popular meat, it is nutritious, and it is the major protein source for poor people. VAT-free chicken will therefore bring immediate economic and nutritional benefits to the poor, particularly children. There are concerns about the cost of VAT-free chicken. The discussion in Parliament should be about the best way to implement it and relieve the burden on those who suffer most from rising food prices. MPs, through this process, have an opportunity to do what is in the best interest of the poor and struggling households. And in doing so, they can ensure that poor households have access to meals that are high in nutrition and protein. Added to this, this committee is requested to launch a thorough review of the current VAT-free basket.
Thank you, sir. I turn your attention to the committee report of the Standing Committee on Finance that was tabled last week on the Tax Laws Administration Bill, Amendment Bill, where the VAT issue is, I think it's two or three pages,
yeah,
is covering what you are saying here. But you are welcome next Wednesday when we, in the NCOP, conduct our public hearings.
Thank you so much.
Just connect with Mr. Rento. He's the secretary of that committee.
Sir, let me just do what I failed to do at the start. My name is Lionel Ardendorf, and I'm an activist with a Fair Play Movement, a not-for-profit organization that seeks to fight predatory trade practices. And we are currently working in and with the sugar industry and the poultry industry, also looking at how to ensure the sustainability and the effectiveness of those industries that we work with, and that is what brings us here.
Thank you. It's a People's Parliament. Your views and recommendations are very important to Parliament. Honourable members, we're going into discussions, and you are going to be limited. If there's crucial questions you want to put to the stakeholders, I can just come around here. Mr. Rensberg, just move also to this side that you can be seen by the members. Honourable members, questions? Number one, number two, in that order?
Thank you, Chair. I'd like
to go to who you are putting your question. Yeah.
100%. I'd like to welcome the report from the Budget Justice Coalition. I think that was very informative. And I'm not going to lie. I think your document is amazing, and the recommendations broadly that you give, I think, would solve many problems in this country, especially regarding basic education. However, I noticed under your higher education recommendations that mentions that essentially there is policy uncertainty regarding fee-free education, and that then there needs to be some kind of certainty. So I'd be interested to learn what your proposal would be for what that policy should look like, or just more or less the central tenets of what that should contain. I'd also like to welcome Kusatu's report. I definitely support the increased focus on accountability for slashing perks of government officials and applaud lifestyle audits, you know, for senior politicians. However, I'd like to ask what your view is regarding SOEs. If you would get rid of any of them, in that say I have a report here from the FFC, which essentially says that over 10 years. Government has increased debt to SOEs from 8% of GDP to 15.6%. And jointly looking at PBO's report plus the FFC's one, that essentially says that we're going to break the debt ceiling by 2.9 billion rand because of bailouts to SOEs, and even goes on to say that this could result in a further credit downgrade for the country. I'd just like to broadly get... Yeah, just, you know, would you shut down any of the SOEs? Do you believe all of them are sustainable? Because every year or every budget cycle, more or less, we get a repeated turnaround strategy or plan from SOEs, essentially trying to convince us that this time, this is the one that's going to save a certain SOE, and that now this, you know, particular bailout would be the final one, and it's going to solve the problems. I'm almost finished, Chair. I'd just like to agree then with UNICEF, especially regarding the looking at sanitation issues in schools. We did actually have a committee meeting of the Standing Committee on Appropriations, where it was shown that there are more than 4,000 schools in South Africa that have still have pit toilets. And I can't remember right now if it's 4,600 or 4,200. And even projections show that after the next 12 months, it's still going to be just under 4,000. So I think all of us here, coming from different spaces and having different opinions, I think it looks like there's at least an increased agreement from everyone to different extents that we need to monitor spending better, especially the efficiency of spending, and we need to know what government is spending money on. Thank you, Chair.
The principle of following money in your constituency when you do constituency oversight, that is crucial. Although Kabasa?
Yeah, Chairperson, let me also start with the submission on higher education, where it talks about the policy regarding fee-free higher education. I also am not quite certain. Perhaps we need an explanation, because it was clarified what categories of students would be served at least at this initial stage of fee-free higher education. I'm not so sure what kind of policy you are referring to, and how it should then address that particular issue. If you could expand on that. Two, COSATU, if you could, I don't know whether Chairperson, it would be possible to do that in this meeting. If you could, expand on the extent of illicit trade and the effect it has on jobs and the economy, and of course specify how should that be dealt with decisively, because this issue has been talked about around in the finance, in standing committee, in trade and industry, and so on, but nothing quite tangible seems to be coming through. How should we address that? Include in that comment the illicit capital outflows, whether you're talking tax avoidance or evasion, and the extent of that, and how it should be nipped in the bud. Oftentimes, when this issue is being referred to, we almost say SARS must deal with it. Is SARS the only body that must deal with it? My sense is that it's not only SARS. So if you could comment on that as well. Lastly, both COSATU and Fair Play on the chicken question, particularly chicken imports. You know, if you drive along Pietermaritzburg, I come from that area, you see structures where, what's this, chicken, yes, Rainbow, closing down, buildings being brought down, and you physically see the impact thereof. If you could comment on that, the extent of that. But also there is this, we have two organizations. The organization that supports chicken imports and one that supports chicken exports. Now, it seems to me quite a contradiction. I'm not so sure whether the one that support exports would probably be focusing on other chicken products that we might not be quite advanced in having in producing in the country, or its wholesale, wholesale import of chicken protein, which then kills our industry. If you could talk to that as well, thank you.
I refer honourable members to the committee report of the Standing Committee on Finance and the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry on the matter of illicit financial flows. Maybe the staff can retrieve that from that secretariat and circulate it to our members. There were a couple of public hearings on the specific issue. Any other questions, honourable member? Speaking to the mic. Thank you.
Facing the other way, sorry. Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you very much to all the presenters. If my starting point would be just to say that, the midterm budget by its nature is full of challenges. Because it's not as if there's some budget that has just come, but it's full of trade-offs, of adjustments, and all sorts of things. So you will find a lot of challenges. But I do want to just speak to the presentation by the Budget Justice Coalition in terms of, well, let me use the example of basic education, where you have raised concerns about the reduction in the allocation. But in the same breath, you yourself have also mentioned the fact that they've been struggling to spend the money. In a situation like that, it becomes very, very difficult, because then this is a time when you need to make some changes and shift funds around, and obviously those funds, rather than not being spent, they would be spent elsewhere. It's not a case of whether it's right or wrong, but it is the situation as it stands, it is the economy the way it is, and it's a reality that we have to deal with, that things have got to be shifted around. While all your points are quite relevant, but the problem is that now in the midterm we've got this particular challenge. So I'm just going to use that one example. I don't want to talk about everything. I don't really have questions, but I think that was quite a progressive presentation. I do agree with most of the things that you raised, and not necessarily 100%. I don't necessarily say I'm endorsing everything, but I think it's quite a progressive presentation as well, because you are coming up, I like the way you are coming up with proposals, which are actually the thinking from that. So I won't necessarily ask a question. This one of the advocacy project. I just want to speak to something about the NHI that you've raised. That it's like you, but you say there's no commitment with regard to the NHI. I'm not very clear what that means, but I know for a fact that the NHI is going ahead. And I also know that there was a budget that the NHI program, that could not be used in the NHI program due to various reasons, but they were not yet ready for implementation. And that money has to be used one way or another, and I think there was some budget shift. Fair play. I wanted to talk about the chicken thing. The long story about the chicken. Agree with you very much that actually it is the cheapest meat source that poor people use. I think that's one of the reasons why they use it. But in terms of it being zero rated, my question is just that to ask if perhaps at the time when people were asked to make submissions, if there was any attempt from your side to actually propose that it be zero rated as well. Because that was also a good opportunity while I acknowledge what you are proposing, but you know there was that time when we were able to also make submissions. Thank you. I think I would end there, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you for your questions, honorable members. To our stakeholders, I'm going to give you each two minutes to reply. Sorry for this, but it's unfortunate.
Okay, it seems I must speak of first, Comrade Chair. I think just four quick points. I think the first one on slashing perks, lifestyle audit. I think our plea there in one sentence, Chair, would be for government to be brutal on those kind of things. Workers, voters are very demoralized. They need a sense of hope to see Tumamina being very harshly implemented across the board, Chair. We don't need to be soft on other people. Chair, in terms of SOEs, I think in a nutshell, look, we know you can't have endless bailouts. We'll collapse the state. We think, Chair, that all of the SOEs, there is a viable business opportunity for them. SAA made profit in 2011. It used to be the best airline in the continent. With proper leadership, which I think is slowly turning things around, it can come right. But Chair, I think we need to see across all the SOEs really comprehensive forensic audits from top to bottom, not just here and there where there's smoke, but across the board. We think we can turn things around. We need to give space for the new management. I think, Chair, we must also acknowledge we have a credible president right now, a credible minister of public enterprises, who are not interfering in the running of the SOEs like we had previously. We think that will help make a difference. But we know it's touch and go right now. And that's why we're kind of urging a sense of urgency in government to really move fast on saving the ships. We think, Chair, for example, there's even opportunity to create new jobs, like for Eskom. The next wave of industrial technology is around electric vehicles. We're lucky to have a significant car manufacturing industry and buses. If we can start gearing towards investing in electric vehicles, we can export to the rest of the continent. We can create new jobs. If we sort of Eskom's ridiculous tariff hikes and reliability, we can once again export to neighboring states and to Africa. Those are ways to grow those sectors, Chair, because electricity is not going to disappear. We need it no matter what. I think, Chair, to Honorable Kubaza, around the illicit trade, I think we can really highlight two key sectors that we can give more detailed written documents on it. We're really pleased with the finance committees of parliament, etc., to really squeeze SARS around it. We have highlighted how customs collections for the textile industry used to be about R1 billion a year. It's plummeted to about R5 million. And you can see in any store around the country, just go into Plain Street, all the shops have got made in China t-shirts. It's across the board and really threatening thousands of jobs. We think there is chances to work close there. And we have had extensive engagements between SACTU, our clothing affiliate, industry, DTI and SARS around how to turn the ship around. You'll be amazed, Chair, that in customs enforcement at the ports, there's not a scientific approach to checking which containers. It's not all containers that are checked. It's really random. So as part of the job summit agreement is to increase those inspections, especially targeting repeat offenders. But really it needs to go beyond that. All containers should simply be inspected. It's very bizarre. On the tobacco thing, Chair, and really you saw a prime example of state capture on the tobacco industry. How SARS's dedicated unit was disbanded by the previous commissioner for very dodgy reasons at best, and how the explosion of tobacco has been there. But that's not just the issue of flooding of imports coming in. There's also collusion by the local tobacco producers in Eastern Cape and Gauteng, where they've got the hands of both sides of the fence. But sure, again, if you go to any shop, you'll find the legal pack of cigarettes at R40 a pack, whatever it is. Then you'll find whole bunch of others which everyone is now buying, especially in working class areas. Those packs go for R10. So it's far below the tax that must be paid to SARS, which is R70. So I propose, Chair, and maybe it might be too late for this parliamentary term, but then the next parliamentary term, on the first point of agenda, when you come back as chairperson, Honourable Chair.
Oh, you're doing the deployment?
Yes. We're going to campaign for both chairpersons, who both speak nice Afrikaans, is that we must amend the laws to say that you can only sell tobacco at the tax level, number one, and that it'd be a serious criminal offense not to do it. We need to see people sitting in prison have hefty fines, because otherwise what we're going to see happen in the next 2 years, Chair, is that your syntax is going to collapse for tobacco. We're going to see an explosion of smoking by young people, because you go to the spaza shops, you can buy the loose cigarette for 50 cents. Then lastly, Chair, around poultry, I think simply like with Fair Play, we believe it's a key nutritional item. It can help boost the local industry, which has been battered by subsidized cheap imports from Brazil, from the US. We think it can be targeted and be affordable to the fiscus. But I think, Chair, we also need to have an engagement properly around this contradiction between the importers, who really want to flood the local economy with cheap subsidized meat from the US, Brazil, Europe, and how we need to protect the agricultural sector, which is the most strategic sector of the economy. It's the largest non-state employer for hundreds of thousands of low-skilled workers.
You must start wrapping up, please.
And that's the chip, I think. Thank you.
Thank you, Matthew.
Chair.
Yeah, let's take the first row and then the gentleman sitting there.
Yeah, I know. Foul play or fair play. Thank you, honourable members. Look, I don't doubt that the government's commitment to the implementation of the NHI, and I think the big, and as the Rural Health Advocacy Project, we are huge supporters of that. But I think if you look at across the various programs under the control of the National Department of Health, it's really discouraging that underperforming programs like the infrastructure grant were spared, and the NHI indirect grant, which in effect is our pilot for how we will implement this program, became the target of reprioritization. That was on the first level. On the second level, 350 million rand does nothing really to address an HRH crisis. What we need is a deeper engagement to understand where the gaps are so that we can fix them correctly. Another thing, it was in a whole, what is the word we use in government nowadays, the quantum of needs or priorities. It almost seemed nonsensical to see 150 million rand being allocated to laundry when we have no contraceptives within the systems because of stockouts, or we have persistent accruals or hidden deficits that's delaying our infrastructure, our ability to deliver. So I think the point that as the Rural Health Advocacy Project and also with the Budget Justice Coalition we'd like to make is that yes, we admit there's a crisis, yes, there's a way out, we have a lot of money. Let's try and understand how best we can deploy what we have to achieve and prioritize those people most in need. If we do it in a haphazard way, the NHI will cost us more and deliver less of the social impact that we want as citizens and as I'd rather not say that as people in South Africa, because South Africa belongs to all who live in it. The NHI is important and we must do it. And I think I refer the members back to the Health Market Inquiry, which gives us a sense that it's not just the public sector healthcare delivery that is under strain or that's in need of reform. It's also the private sector. So it's the most important project in this next phase of our democracy, and I fully support it. My concern was that by taking money out of the indirect grant, which should be laying the platform for how we deliver and reform healthcare services, we send the wrong message. I understand the trade-offs, but there were other trade-offs that we could have made, and the signal that we sent by taking money from the NHI indirect grant was problematic. Another level of concern, which I didn't cover in my presentation, but I'm going to use my 2 minutes to address it, is the two centers of power that we've created indirectly in the management and the oversight of health as a overall. I think the president was very well-intentioned when he brought health into the presidency as a strategic focus. Unfortunately, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. We just saw a news report this morning in the Business Day where the current DG, who is the accounting officer for health, has had no sight of the amended NHI bill. And I think that's the kind of things that we're trying to move away from and not towards. And I think this is a matter that the committee and parliament needs to take up, because the responsibility for the health budget lies with the DG, not with the president's special advisor. And we need to make sure that we protect our NHI and we protect the right to health. Thank you.
Budget Coalition.
Thank you very much for the questions, honourable members. I'm just going to start off with a comment around basic education that you made, member. And I think the biggest thing I want to stress there is that despite the
trends of under-expenditure that I noted both at national level and infrastructure level, I think the important thing to note is that not only we as civil society organization, but also, you know, the National Treasury still realizes the importance of infrastructure provision. And that is why in the Adjustments Appropriation Bill, despite under-expenditure, particularly in the SIBG, we have seen that there's been an 800 million rand that has been reallocated and reprioritized, which tells us that despite the issues, there's still so much more backlog that needs to be addressed, to that we need to start focusing on what is contributing to the under-expenditure and how do we stop it, because it's too big of a program to sanction due to under-expenditure, because our children on the ground end up paying for it in very severe ways. And then returning to the comments about higher education, so firstly, when I speak about the non-existence of a policy, that basically refers to the fact that former president mentioned that poor and working class students would now qualify for free higher education, and that NASFAS would continue as the current vehicle through which this is provided, but no new benchmarks for the increased provision were created. So basically accommodation, meals and transport, all of that NASFAS in-house had to now re-strategize and recreate packages for which they've never had to before, because usually NASFAS will take about 40,000 students. There's a cap on how much per student is going to be spent. But now, when you have an increase, double that amount, and they've got no guidelines on what the accommodation per student is going to be. And also remember, it's across 23 public institutions, so all of those different things differ. And the biggest contributor to this is because NASFAS has recently centralized all of its work. So before, it had the help of institutions to help create these guidelines and benchmarks, but suddenly it's doing it on its own. There hasn't been a policy or legislative framework that basically says that this is how free higher education will work. Granted, the MTBPS did mention that what they're waiting to do is do a cost evaluation of how much this year had cost them to try and set in those guidelines, but what the recommendations that we mentioned in the BJC submission are around putting pressure to make sure that there is a policy document that can help us going forward, and also it's supposed to be on a phased-in process. So we know what's happened in the first year, but what happens in terms of postgraduate students, what happens to returning students, all of which are things that are not set out in the current NASFAS policy. And just to wrap it up with tenets that we think are very important in terms of what should be in this policy, the first thing would be that to keep free higher education as a public competency or as a public good. And one thing that is concerning is that earlier this year, NASFAS had amendments which allowed it to enter into PPPs, which are the public-private partnerships. And there's also been this looming sense that the EcoSasa Student Financial Aid Program might be the new vehicle, which essentially says that everyone will basically be in debt by the time they come out. So the biggest thing is that governance needs to stay as transparent as it is as a public good, and we're worried about the potential privatization of higher education, which in impact would entrap our students in debt if that's the way that it goes. And in terms of provision, also continue with the prioritization of poor and working class students, but also importantly, TVET sector and other historically black universities, which haven't received the same sort of resources and are part of why WUSU, Fort Hare, Orbit College are all behind in terms of, you know, in terms of higher education provision, and also why we, you know, our students often don't see them as attractive universities, when actually when you graduate a DCT and you graduate at Fort Hare, you still come up with the exact same degree. And just to wrap up, I'm finishing.
Yes, please.
The last thing would be in terms of sustainability, the private sector is one of the biggest beneficiaries of our graduates, which are completely government funded, but have very little input when it comes to cultivating that new culture and knowledge of those students that they then hire later. So I would think that the biggest thing is to try and find ways to incentivize private sector to actively participate in building the future that they then get to groom later as students and in their internships. Thank you.
Thank you. UNICEF?
Thank you very much, Chair. So thanks for I think the the kind of recognition in terms of the thrust of our comments around, recognizing, first of all, that actually, whilst there's always room for more expenditure, but there has been, over a number of years, strong commitment to expenditures on priority social programs. Around about 9 to 10% of GDP has been maintained. So that's an encouraging sign. However, the kind of issues that have been alluded to around underspend and spend that could be a lot more effective, I think those are the things that should be addressed immediately, because those will bring immediate and tangible rewards if addressed. And I think a number of measures can be taken. For example, the issues around making sure that national priorities are actually reported against. So, for example, violence against women and children is a national priority, and it's done through discretionary spending and the equitable share. However, it's important to know what progress is being made and how our resources are being channeled to addressing those issues. Also, the spending areas, again, a very technical issue, but has a big impact on the way government can plan and budget, as well as a big impact on service providers. And then also the kind of innovation and a little bit of perhaps monitoring on unit costs, particularly related to infrastructure. We use school sanitation as an example, where you could perhaps through innovation further drive down unit costs, because that has a double positive impact, because it means the money goes further, but also that things can be done quicker as well. And as we know from recent events, it is a very, very area where we can't afford to wait. And we've been privileged to work a little bit with the Department of Basic Education on the measures that they're taking, and that's been fantastic. And I think we should support and drive that further. To do things more and quicker, more effectively and quicker. But thank you.
I like the word quicker and add to that quality.
Chair, I saved you on my 15 minutes. If I run out of my 2 minutes, I hope you'll grant me that.
Behind you,
yes, so, I have three questions directed at me. I just want to make the point that Fairplay or I are not speaking on behalf of the chicken industry. But we do understand the challenges that the poultry industry has. And currently we are producing around 20% less than we consume. And then around 20% is then imported. And that is the bone-in meat, like the wings and all of those that is not being consumed elsewhere, that's then sent here. And that is why the Fair Play movement, and one of the obstacles to, for instance, export to EU countries is the EU SADC EPA that currently restricts South Africa to export chicken to European countries. And therefore, it is the Fair Play movement is now in agreement with the South African Poultry Association's definition of what they consider a basic or whole chicken for inclusion on the VAT-free basket. Because if you include the entire chicken co-chairs, it would mean that these pieces that are being imported into South Africa would not qualify. So, and therefore, as I said, we did not have a definition, but we do like the definition that SAPA produced. And that's just my input on the import and export. On zero-rated proposals, chair, co-chairs, we have made proposals even to Parliament, to the Standing Committee. This is the first time that we're making it here. And we've also participated in the Woolard panel of expert process where the other four proposals were then presented. When we talk about trade-offs, chair, the Fair Play movement is much more interested in the best trade-offs. And therefore, we consider even the inclusion of the two products on the list as announced by the minister. We consider the inclusion of those two products as much as it is important. We almost consider it reckless because the entire list was not reconsidered.
So instead of saving the fiscus, we add to it. So if we, for instance, took something off the list, and then we would have had a better argument, then we would have saved the fiscus. And that's why we have two products in our site, for instance, and that is pulches. That are currently, if you look at the TAC for pulches as announced by DAF, it is at its lowest where it has ever been in the last 20 years for pulches. So around 70% of the pulches in our cans are imported. It's not caught in local waters. So why is it then that the benefit, or 70% of the benefit, goes elsewhere? If we look at at our production of dry beans, for instance, it is currently at 20% of what it was 30 years ago. And again, 80% of our dry beans and lentils are being imported. So why is it that those two products, only those two, that are so heavily dependent on imports, why is it that they continue to be on the list at the expense of the consumer, at the expense of the fiscus? And therefore, we do think that if we focus the current list, as it was then, on local produce, we will have a much better result, and we might save the fiscus the money that is needed.
Thank you. Honourable members, thank you for the stakeholders making their submissions this morning in this public hearing. Thank you for your contributions. Honourable members, that brings us to the end of the business of the joint meeting. Honourable co-chair, are there any announcements from your side for the joint meeting?
I just would like to thank all the participants in this joint meeting. Indeed, we value your invaluable contributions. And of importance to us, we will look at both your recommendations and check on how we can best use that information to make an impact in our work. So thank you very much.
The joint meeting is adjourned. The standing committee members must just stay behind for the next meeting. Thank you.